purpose. Hashem.
Maybe it goes and goes.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to our second public hearing. The subject of this afternoon's hearing is going to be a discussion of the re-entry of the Space Shuttle Columbia. And we'll hear from several witnesses this afternoon. First one is Dr. William Ehler. Dr. Ehler is the director, Center for Orbital and Reentry Debris Studies from the Aerospace Corporation. We're very thankful, Dr. Ehler, for you taking time to come down here and help us walk through this. What the board is interested in is, first of all, a non-NASA view of how things re-enter the atmosphere, which will help us form our questions for later this afternoon when we get the detailed analysis of how the Columbia entered the atmosphere. And your presentation will help us understand a much greater degree what we hear later. Dr. Ehler, I would offer to ask you to give us a short bio or short background of your background, if you please, and then if you're prepared to start, we are prepared to listen. Welcome.
Okay. Thank you very much. Just by way of background, I joined Aerospace in 1974 and basically been working reentries ever since that time. I'll go over in my presentation a little bit more detail on some of the ones we've worked on before, the Aerospace established the Center for Orbital and Reentry Debris Studies back in 1997 in recognition of the kinds of issues that we expected to see from both space debris and the hazards posed by reentry. And in recognition that there needed to be a fair amount of work done to understand the reentry breakup process, and I'll go over some of that in my presentation. So, and a little bit more background, I did work on the external tank reentry a number of years ago. One of the issues where it was associated with what altitude did that break up, and we worked very closely with NASA in resolving those issues. And then I've also been in various capacities on the Interagency Nuclear Safety Review Panel, which reports to the White House on space missions which carry radioactive materials. So Cassini, Mars Pathfinder, Mars Exploration Rover, we've worked on all of those. So if I could have the first chart. Okay, go back one if you would. No, that's good. I'm sorry. What I want to talk about is what we can learn from reentry debris, and this is really based on the experience that we've had over the last, I'd say, 25 years in this area, actually longer than that. Aerospace has been working in this area for a long time, and our desire has been really to understand the breakup process. Again, you know, these things coming down through the atmosphere can present a hazard to people and property on the ground. One of our objectives has been to understand what that hazard is and to be able to model it and perhaps minimize it as time goes on. So what I've got here is an overview of the reentry breakup process. This is just for a standard reentry, and as I'll show you in a minute, we see a number of these a year. But for a typical satellite reentering, it slowly comes down through the atmosphere, slowly works its way down out of orbit in an orbit decay fashion, or in fact you can actually drive something into the atmosphere, and I'll talk about that in a bit as well. Basically, for an unprotected space hardware, the heating and loads will gradually tear it apart. And I'll talk more about that in a minute. The kinds of things that we've seen that survive reentry are things that you would probably guess might. Things like steel, and sometimes, and I'll talk about that, glass, titanium, and then parts that are sheltered by other parts. One of the things about the reentry breakup process is that there's the heating, it's like, in a sense, cooking an onion. You basically start from the outside, and then as you heat the pieces up to a point where the materials will fail, that'll expose some new materials. They'll go through the same process, and the object can be broken apart. We do have objects that are melted and shedded away, things like aluminum, solar panels, things like that come off pretty early, Mylar sheets, satellites, some are wrapped in Mylar sheets. Once this debris comes off from the parent body, it follows its own trajectory at that point. So it will go on about its business basically based on its own properties. If it's a very dense, heavy piece, for example, it may go further. If it's a very lightweight piece like a solar panel, something like that, it'll fall early in the trajectory. And then the debris pieces impact on the footprint on the ground, and I've got an illustration there that just shows that typically what we see is initial breakup or shedding. These are things like solar panels that come off pretty quickly. We have a catastrophic breakup. I'll talk some more about that, but typically it can be quite a substantial event. There'll be secondary breakups that happen when those pieces come apart. And then you see a footprint where you get low mass debris that comes in early, and typically longer, heavier pieces go late. We'll talk some more about that as well. Next chart. Okay, so it's just some characteristics of reentry breakup. It's characterized by intense heating and major fragmentation. And as I mentioned, fragments are shed as the structure heats and fails. Typically, we see instantaneous high lows. For example, when an object comes off of a parent body, it now experiences the airstream that exists there, and it will respond based on its own characteristics. For example, if you've got a very lightweight piece that comes off of a heavier object that's coming through the atmosphere, then it will see a very happy, it's like throwing a piece of paper out of a car. That'll decelerate very quickly, and the same thing happens even at Mach 20. So when you do that, you see very high loads, and you can also see very high heating. That can be important if you're trying to understand what actually happened in a process, because now you've got an object that's been separated from a parent body that will have seen, just because of its own interaction with the atmosphere, will have seen a fairly severe environment. You can have some events with moderate velocity increment. What I mean by that is if you've got a tank, fuel tank, or something like that that explodes, like a balloon, some of those fragments will pick up some velocity increment from that. Typically not, we've measured as high as 1,000 feet per second. And the initial breakup can be energetic. Basically, a typical way for things to break up when they reenter is that they'll come down through the atmosphere for a certain amount of time. They look absolutely fine. We've seen videos of these things where they just look like a spacecraft coming down. All of a sudden, they come apart. And when they come apart, they just disintegrate. That altitude typically is around 42 nautical miles, plus or minus a few nautical miles, but that's a pretty good guess. So just as a rule of thumb, it seems like a critical point for spacecraft reentry and breakup is around 42 miles. We have never had any measurements internal to a spacecraft during this breakup process, and that's something that we would like to see. It'll really help us understand the process better. Next chart. Okay, survivability depends on a number of factors. The material, for example, the melting point of the material, the heat capacity. Just by example, it's very rare to find aluminum on the ground from a standard spacecraft reentry, and finding aluminum on the ground would basically mean that aluminum was somehow protected as it came down. Steel can survive. It doesn't have to, though. We have cases, for example, there was a Russian satellite that came down in Canada, had a steel reactor case. That reactor case basically was disintegrated during the reentry. But we also, I'll show you some pictures of some steel that did. The size, shape, and weight. An empty fuel tank is, in a sense, a lightweight object relative to its size. That will affect its survivability, and that can be very important. For example, fuel tanks survive. Things as dense as a battery, we've never found a battery on the ground. The release conditions, if an object comes out late in a reentry, after being shielded for a portion of the reentry, that means that a lot of the energy has been taken out of that trajectory prior to that object's release, and that object is more likely to survive. And shielding, again, objects that have been shielded for portion of the reentry can survive. And that's one reason, by the way, that we do find, for example, you can find circuit boards on the ground from satellite reentries. And what that means is typically if when a satellite's being constructed, circuit boards are built internal to other boxes, which are built internal to other structures and so forth. So again, if you think about this heating process where you're removing the outer layers as you come in, every time you do that, you're removing energy, and then finally these things will survive, be released. Next chart. When these things come down, there's a typically generated debris footprint. Now, this is a notional footprint here, and I've got several breakup conditions separated by about 30 seconds in trajectory time. And this shows things like the types of dispersions that we typically see. This has got dispersions in winds, so winds will affect things as they fall, even a big heavy object, as I'll show you in a minute. In ballistic coefficient is a measure of, in a sense, how dense an object is, and that will affect where things go. Typically, on these footprints, at least, for example, in the red swatch you see up there, things that have gone longest downrange, farthest to your right, would be a heavier object. The lighter objects would hit towards the uprange portion. And then atmospheric density, we don't quite know what density is on most trajectories, and so in that case we have to build a factor in to allow for that. And then also, as I mentioned, it's possible to get some velocity increment as things come down, and so we've put in a delta P for that. So basically what you can see here is these ellipsoids were generated at each of these time intervals. And you can see how they overlay each other. Now, if you look carefully at breakup 4 down there, that's one where the trajectory is now healed over a bit. And you can see that even though the same types of debris are there, the footprint is inside of the one just prior to that. This indicates that trying to figure out where debris came from on a reentering spacecraft and where it happened is a very difficult process indeed. These are four specific time steps. What you have to recognize is this is basically happening continuously as the spacecraft reenters. So the footprint is not even as nice as what you see here. Next chart, please. Noteworthy reentries, to just give you a little background, it was mentioned earlier, someone said that this is not a data-rich area, and I have to agree with that. What you see here are some of the primary data sources for doing this type of work. Cosmos 954 came down in 1978. That was a reactor-powered satellite, and there was radioactive debris that came down in Canada. Since it was radioactive, you could find it pretty easily, and it was a lot of that debris was recovered and was examined and documented. That's probably the exception on these kinds of things. Typically, the effort is simply not put forward to find debris on the ground, so we simply don't have as much. Skylab occurred in 1979. Some of the debris fell in Australia. There was some debris found, but again, there's really no detailed analysis of the footprint itself, as far as I'm aware. And then I'll show you some pictures of some delta second stages in a minute, but we do have large debris pieces surviving from that. We did reconstruct the trajectories and try to understand the breakup of those. And there were two targeted reentries. As I say, the ones above that were all basically, in a sense, brought down just by the atmosphere itself. In other words, the atmosphere drags things out of orbit slowly. The last two were actually targeted into ocean areas because of the potential hazard they posed. The Compton Gamma Ray Observatory, that was targeted to an ocean area. There was no debris found from that one. And then the Mir Space Station was also targeted to an ocean area. The only debris I'm aware that was found was reported by a guy who was beachcombing down in Fiji, a job I'd like to have. So, but he did have one piece that's not been substantiated that actually came from Mir, but likely Mir had debris surviving and it may float up on a beach somewhere. Next chart. The type of work that you can do with a reentry, and as far as reconstruct what actually happened to it, there are a number of things that you need to do. For example, there's maybe tracking data, for example, radar data, video data, for example, the type of thing that people would take if there are people who've seen it from aircraft. Any of that kind of data can be very useful in rebuilding what's happened in a reentry breakup. public sightings and witnesses. We have, on most of the entries that we've got here, the public actually has seen some of these things coming down, and that information has been very useful in rebuilding what happened during the reentry. Debris on the ground, knowing where things are, what they look like, whether how much they weigh, all of that information can be critical to rebuilding rebuilding what happened, and that's one reason why the work that's going on now, both from the public and other agencies looking for debris, is really critical to this investigation. And then data on the original vehicle. It's one thing to have debris on the ground, but you need to know what the original configuration was like. Normally, I should say, sometimes we simply don't have good information on that. If it's a foreign satellite, something like that, we may not know exactly what was coming through the atmosphere, so we don't have a good feel for trying to take the debris back up. The next thing you do is really try to fuse all that information together and basically rebuild the reentry trajectory, try to match the impact locations to possible release points, and take any existing weather data, any of that sort of thing in. And then finally conduct metallurgical analyses on the debris to estimate temperatures, really look at what went on, those kinds of things. Next chart. This is an example of a reentry. This one came down over Canada. This was in 1997, and you can see that on that chart we show a breakup altitude at the magic 42 nautical mile number, and there's some fragments, and we'll talk more about those, but this is one. And then this again, the public was out. This was about 3 o'clock in the morning. There were reports to news stations and so forth, and we actually used that information. Next chart. This is some pictures of the debris recovered from that one, and this is one of larger debris fields, I guess, that we've actually had a chance to see. And as I say, typically, unless it lands next to a farmer's house, as you see in the that chart there, people don't find these things unless they happen to be out and about. So up what you see in the upper left corner is the this is the it's gonna work. Apparently not. The original configuration as it's being loaded onto the launch vehicle is up there. There actually was a satellite on the top of that. This stage was released in orbit and was in orbit for about 9 months, and then gradually the atmosphere dragged it down. The big brown tank you see over there, is about 570-pound stainless steel tank, landed about 50 yards from a farmer's house here in Texas. He was not pleased. And the woman you see on the top right actually was brushed on the shoulder by a piece of the debris. Again, she was very, very lucky, but it was a very lightweight piece. The sphere you see down here was one of four on that vehicle. That was the only one found, although we believe they all survived. So they're still on the ground somewhere. And the bottom one just shows that these things can survive in pretty good condition. Those are screws that you actually could unscrew. They held an aluminum plate onto the tank itself, and the aluminum is gone, but the screws were still there and just fine. Next chart. This, again, gives you a little detail on that one. Again, 550-pound tank, 67-pound titanium sphere, and 100-pound thrust chamber. Footprint length was about 400 nautical miles long on this one. Next chart. This is a detail of the trajectory reconstruction. The trajectory comes in from the top, and each of those little black dots is about 2 seconds apart. So you can see just by the spread of those dots that it's moving at a pretty good clip originally, and that's up at around 18 nautical miles up. When you get down to around 10 nautical miles, it looks like it's does a little dog leg there, and that is, you're absolutely right, due to winds. So basically, when an object of this type comes into the atmosphere, typically they are all the orbital and all that motion is gone. The atmosphere has taken that energy out, and it will fall from, say, 50,000 feet straight down. That's one reason why when you see debris on the ground, even in the pictures of the farmer's house with the debris there, you'll notice there's really no crater. Most people don't realize these things just fall straight down and they just land, and that's just a characteristic of this. And that little dog leg is again caused by winds and hit the jet stream and it blew it over there. This again was a 570-pound tank, so you can see that even that can be moved. Next chart. One of the things that we did was we were able to get a portion of this fragment that brushed Lottie Williams on the shoulder, and we actually wanted to find out if, in fact, that did come from the launch vehicle or from that vehicle. We analyzed that and found that, if you'll take the next page, please, that it did, the trajectory time was consistent. She was out walking at around 3:30 in the morning and actually saw the reentry, and then this thing came down, brushed her on the shoulder, and she recovered that. And then we did get a piece. We brought it into our labs. We did an energy dispersive X-ray analysis of it, and there are actually two on this little red chart you see here. There are actually two lines there. One is the original material, and the second is what was recovered. So we are very confident that this material actually came from that vehicle. Next chart. The second thing we did is take samples from the large tank itself, put it through a metallurgical analysis. We found, for example, that in portions, the aluminum actually combined with the stainless steel, and we were able to use that to pin down the maximum temperature on the tank at between 1200 and 1280 degrees centigrade. And the other interesting thing, and I'll show you another example of this, is it appears that this aluminum splashing back from, again, the aluminum is there on other parts of the structure, that the aluminum splashing back on the tank can actually oxidize or burn, and the heat released by that can melt holes, and we believe that's why the hole was actually melted in this tank. Next chart. Just to show you, this is not all that an unusual event. This is some pictures that were of basically the same debris objects. These came down near Cape Town, South Africa in April of 2000, and it's basically the same objects. Next chart. This is another one we have. This is a solid rocket motor stage that came down in Saudi Arabia. This one is made out of titanium, which makes it a little unusual. The ones you saw before were typically out of steel. This is titanium. Titanium would be expected to survive very nicely. And we have evidence, again, that the hole you see here was actually burned, in a sense, in the casing as the aluminum oxidized on it. Next chart. So just learning a little bit from the debris and the limitations there, we typically model reentry breakup at the macro level. We simply don't have a good understanding of what happens at the micro level with these kinds of things, simply because we don't have a lot of data to base our models on at that level. We do have a few reentries where significant debris is found, but just by way of information of the stages that came down in Texas and South Africa, we have about ten of those that come down a year. Those are the only two we've found, only two where debris has been found. So most of these land in the water or in places where they're just not discovered. And we also see about 100 reentries of major objects a year. So again, finding debris on the ground is very unusual, although I have to say we do get hits on our website. People email us with things they've found and ask us if that potentially is of that type. Just by rule of thumb, we would estimate that about anywhere from 10 to 40% of an object will actually survive reentry. And that can depend on what it's made out of. If it's got some big heavy empty fuel tanks, that can really be a factor there. There's been relatively little work on reconstructing reentry breakup events. The ones I've mentioned are about all there are. And again, one of the most important features is that there's really been no systematic retrieval effort, except in a couple of cases. I guess the Cosmos 954 would be an exception. And again, the objective there was to recover the radioactive material. Next chart. Some observations. As I mentioned, the heating to an object can really be exacerbated by burning of other material. For example, this phenomenon of aluminum splashing back and the heat of oxidation actually increasing the temperature and burning holes. We believe that is a real situation. There are large aerodynamic deceleration loads, and also you've got an object that's already been fairly well heated as the reentry progresses, so that can lead to structural failure and actually can mask other information about what happened during the breakup. Combining data from multiple sources can be critical for reconstructing a reentry event. And finally, the distribution of debris on the footprint may actually be very useful in providing clues on the breakup sequence itself. So things like if you find objects early in a trajectory, that can be really very critical to seeing what how that the reentry progressed. Next chart. So in summary, reentry breakup is not well characterized at the micro level. That breakup and subsequent disintegration can and does destroy clues of critical events. The debris field may be very useful in helping to track down what ultimately happened. Data fusing, is really a critical part of this. You really must take everything that you can learn, all the data you can get, and try to reconstruct what you've what the event was. And then a final piece of that is laboratory analysis of the debris pieces themselves to look for things that may have been can be shown to have occurred earlier or have been protected by other objects as the event progressed. And I think that's my briefing, sir.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Dr. Ayler. Mm-hmm. All right, panel. I know we've got some questions. Scott, go ahead.
Okay, yes, Dr. Ayler, thanks for being here with us. We appreciate someone of your expertise speaking to us. I have two questions that are follow-ups on some statements that you made. One is about the percentage of material that have been recovered in your previous database.
Right.
Where we are today with the Columbia is something on the order by weight of 15% to 20%.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd like your assessment based on what you know. What do you think this is, a low or high, or what we might expect in the future?
Well, as I mentioned, for typical reentries, we see between, say, 10 and 40%. It really can depend on what the materials the object is made of. There may be significant debris pieces that have yet to be discovered. I don't know, but I would say that's certainly in the range of experience in the past. The other part of this is that we've never had the detailed look or the energetic search for debris that we're seeing now. So it's possible that you may get a higher percentage as time goes on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thank you. The other question was related to your statement about aluminum rarely being found on the ground. We're finding some aluminum, although mixed with other debris or attached to other debris. Can you give us a brief explanation why that might be the case?
Yes. Our experience has been that unprotected aluminum will not survive a reentry event. The heating is just too high. It typically comes off very early in the trajectory. We do find aluminum, say bits of aluminum that has flowed back onto tanks and been protected, say, by a titanium sphere or something like that. It'll flow into the lee side and be protected back there. But we typically don't find that. For debris that you're finding now, it most likely aluminum on the ground was protected during for a significant part of the reentry. And maybe was and probably was released late before, when there wasn't sufficient heating to cause it to melt.
Okay, thank you.
It's a tough one.
Dr. Ayler, one of your charts talked to the five satellites that had broken up in the atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
To put this in perspective, could you tell me how many total pieces in history have we had compared to the 30,000 pieces that we will now be working with from the shuttle?
Well, in history, we actually have examined probably five or six, just to give you an example, the several big tanks and so forth. There was a number of debris pieces that were picked up from the Cosmos 954. I would say in history we're probably talking about in the order of maybe 250 or so that have actually been noticed by humans on the ground and reported.
Mm. Thank you. And one follow-up question. You talked about the ballistic coefficient. For everybody's edification, could you kind of distinguish the difference in the ballistic coefficient between something like a tile, a tank, and maybe a landing gear strut?
So oh, absolutely.
You can put that in perspective.
Ballistic coefficient is a measure of how significant the atmosphere is going. Significantly, the atmosphere is going to affect the flight of an object. And something like the way to think about it is a very low ballistic coefficient object would be very low would be something like a feather. You know, it's extremely low ballistic coefficient. A shuttle tile, for example, released by itself, very light object, would have a very low ballistic coefficient as well. Something with a medium ballistic coefficient would be something like a tank, an empty fuel tank. That big tank I showed you here has a ballistic coefficient on the order of 15 to 20. And then something like you were mentioning, a landing gear strut, I probably would imagine that'd be up maybe 40 to 50, something on that order. So again, what you're looking for is a ball bearing would be something that would have a high ballistic coefficient. So it'd be something that where the aerodynamic properties really would make it less susceptible to the atmosphere, and also its mass properties would give it a lot of inertia.
Thank you.
Yes.
Admiral Turcotte.
In the examples that you gave of the different reentries that you had, they were obviously at different inclinations, and they were at different reentry profiles.
Yes.
Could you kind of explain the difference in what you know of the shuttle's entry profile at that inclination and some of the data that you had in the past from the other satellite reentries?
Yes. The other satellites that I spoke of either were deorbited or basically were orbit decayed down, had very shallow path angles typically. They flew what we'll call ballistic trajectories, which mean there really wasn't much lift involved with them. Of course, the orbiter is a lifting object, and lift did play a big role in its trajectory, for a good portion of it anyway. That trajectory will affect the heating rates and so forth, and will affect how the object responds to the atmosphere.
Mr. Wallace.
This is the first time we've had a breakup of a vehicle designed for reentry. Is that a fair statement?
Of this type, yes.
Does that, this ballpark, it looks like your 42-mile estimate was pretty close, even in the situation of Columbia. I mean, is the fact that this was a vehicle designed for a safe reentry,
right,
change some of your estimates about the percentages you're likely to find and any other sort of effect on the breakup sequence?
Well, it certainly could. As a matter of fact, the fact that there is a heat shielding on a portion of the time, and then some of the body parts after that will affect what survives. That's certainly true. I should mention that the shuttle external tank also is a reentering vehicle after its release from the orbiter during launch. That typically breaks up at a slightly lower altitude, maybe around 40 nautical miles, plus or minus a little bit. And what happens there is that there is some amount of heat shielding, and it does protect it for a little bit. So there are objects where there is a shielding existing, and I think the fact that the breakup sequence, if it can be shown that there was a material loss at a very high altitude for the orbiter, may indicate that there was the shielding, the heat shield, may have had a problem.
Dr. Woodnall?
Yes. You mentioned earlier that aluminum rarely survives,
right,
certainly in its bare state. Could you sort of go over all of the possible things that you could think of happening to aluminum in reentry, both for, say, an individual panel that suddenly found itself all by itself in the atmosphere,
right,
and also maybe a panel, say, on the leading edge, like leading edge spar of the shuttle wing that was attached to the shuttle but was bare?
Mm-hmm.
What are the different range of things that could happen to such aluminum?
Well, I'll give you an example. Some of the work we've done has been looking at a large spacecraft that reentered with solar panels.
Mm-hmm.
And we believe and have data to indicate that the solar panel came off early in that reentry. Some of the data we have makes us believe that that solar panel, even with an aluminum structure, actually survived. So that's a case where, again, you have a big...
So that's ballistic coefficient.
That's exactly right. A big flat plate,
right,
spreads out, stops very quickly, and then just essentially falls to the ground. So something like that could survive. So then that case, aluminum could be expected to survive. If aluminum is being carried along by a heavy object, for example, you saw the tanks we have here. These were big, solid pieces of material. The aluminum is on it as a piece of structure. As it's being carried by that heavier object, it's really governed by the aerodynamic and heating and so forth that's characteristic of that object, and that can be much higher than the aluminum itself can stand. And when that aluminum gets weak, it will come apart. And that's
okay. Well, I'd like to go beyond that.
Sure.
So you're saying melting?
Melting, absolutely.
Vaporization?
Melting, yes. Turned into droplets, exactly.
Well, droplets?
Right.
How about individual atoms? Vaporization?
I would assume you'd have to ask somebody more qualified in that area than I am.
Oxidation?
Oxidation for sure, and we've seen evidence of that.
And of course, another word for oxidation is burning.
Burning, exactly.
Burning. I mean, the example you gave was aluminum deposited on another tank, which essentially burned and created, I suppose it could also burn all by itself.
It could, although aluminum released by itself probably would stay in a droplet form and decelerate pretty quickly. So aluminum that would be carried along by something, I think, would be more likely to see that.
In the hole that was created that you talked about, was that created by the aluminum burning or the alloying effect?
It was by the oxidation of the aluminum itself, and that raised the temperature up where you could actually see this the alloying occur.
I was very interested in your comment about the ball of paper being thrown out the window of the car, not just because that's my level of understanding, but what you suggested was that in an entry scenario like we're investigating here, there's a heating and an aerodynamic force, one of which is extraordinarily fast. And then when the object then becomes free and floats down to earth, it's still got heat, but it's no longer of this extraordinarily short period high intensity. My question is, when we go looking through debris, should we be able to detect those two phenomena? That is a piece of metal which has been flashed, mm-hmm. heated. Versus a piece of metal which has been subjected to prolonged, by prolonged I mean tens of seconds or maybe even more.
Mm-hmm.
Can you see the difference in your experience?
For aluminum to actually see this flash heating, the way that will work is that when an object actually is kicked off, if it's got material attached to it, for example, it's tile material with some substructure attached to it, if it comes out in a way where the tile material is forward and actually protects the material behind it, then that might be likely to survive. But the problem is going to be with, number one, the breakup process is going to continue on about anything. About any object that's put out into the stream is going to continue to see heating for a short period of time. If there's much material there and it's a very low ballistic coefficient item, for example, like a big flat plate with some material behind it, structural material, that'll heat up very quickly, as you say. The aerodynamic loads will also be quite high as soon as it hits the airstream. That can have a tendency to fracture it further. And so this breakup process is going to continue as it comes down. Secondly, the dynamics may actually get into the process. So if this object is tumbling, then different sides will see the airstream. So it will be a difficult process, I think, to try to see a piece on the ground and make sense out of it from that perspective. If you see what I mean?
I think in one of your view graphs, for example, of a sphere that came from one of the deltas or something like that, mm-hmm. in which all of the burn marks all around the sphere look approximately the same,
mm-hmm.
would it be safe to conclude that sphere had been tumbling and all the sides had been subjected to the same amount of heat? Whereas the one that had the hole burned in it, I think it's safe to analyze that was another event of some kind.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of what I'm getting at.
That certainly can be. You're right about that. And as a matter of fact, on one of the delta tanks, one of the spheres, about a 2-foot diameter sphere, one side actually does have droplets of aluminum that are clearly visible on it. The other side is absolutely clean. So you can say that during the heating phase, that one side was facing the heat, the oncoming airstream, and saw more heating than the other side did. Exactly.
Mm-hmm. And another question is, certainly in the case of those spheres, and by the way,
In the case of Columbia, I'd ask Mr. Tetra, we have found essentially 20 out of 25, or?
We found at least 25, not counting fragments, out of approximately 30 that are internal. Yeah, I don't know what the exact count is internal to the structure.
Like, just as you predicted, the spheres all survived.
Mm-hmm.
In the debris field, not discounting the spheres, your suggestion, though, is that in the terminal velocity and the terminal vectors, even when you start off going 10,000 miles an hour, by the time you reach the thick part of the atmosphere, you're essentially dropping vertically.
Correct.
Right. And therefore, it would. How would you characterize whether or not we should find buried debris or not? Would you expect most of the debris to be on or near the surface?
I would expect most of the debris would be on or near the surface. Buried debris would not be typical for a spacecraft reentry. That would require very dense material, and would also require it to have some aerodynamic properties, which you're not going to find on a reentered object.
Yeah. Dr. Hill, I've got two questions for you. You probably have heard that from the second to the fourth day on orbit, there was a piece of debris that was had separated from the shuttle, and then it went on to re-enter.
Mm-hmm.
We have some extensive analysis going on through testing at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base right now, trying to determine the radar characteristics of it. Are there any type of predictive methods that you know of that might tell us by the characteristics of its re-entry what type of material it was?
If we had information on the reentry itself, yes. On the rate of decay, from orbit would be indicative of, you know, the overall aerodynamic properties of the object and its weight. So that would be some useful information to have. If there's tracking data, for example, on the reentry itself, that can be used.
Okay. And then a second question. I looked at your slide that said from the Saudi Arabia reentry back in 2001,
mm-hmm.
Analysis is still ongoing.
Yes.
Which doesn't bode well for us to get back to our day jobs anytime soon, you know, 2 years later.
Well,
can you tell us what we could expect to find through laboratory analysis of the debris in the short term?
In the short term, the critical thing, I think, is going to be to try to center the analysis on certain debris pieces that have some reason to believe have high value. And what I mean by that is if there's debris that can be determined by analysis to have come from a particular part of the vehicle itself that's of interest, then you should really focus on that. I think the initiating event is probably what is of interest here. And so a lot of the final debris that's in the debris field will have happened well after the initiating event, so the search is going on for early debris is really a very intelligent and the right thing to do. And again, the other thing would be to look for the debris field itself and see again if there's a characteristics of the field that would indicate that debris in this area, for example, came from a portion of the orbiter of interest. So I would really try to focus on that. Laboratory analysis, there's just too much debris here to be doing that extensively, so it's going to have to be focused.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Yes, Dr. Woodnall.
Why do things tumble in the atmosphere, and is there a possible diagnostic use of measurements that appear to show something tumbling?
Well, even in orbit, things can tumble. For example, as you come down from orbit, you know, there's still a little bit of atmosphere up there, and so as you get into the portion where there's enough to actually affect the dynamics of an object and have that become more of a principal player, it'll gradually overpower the gravity gradient forces, which are there to try to stabilize the spacecraft, and that interaction then will cause an object to tumble. As you come down through the atmosphere, the mass properties and aerodynamic properties of an object will also cause it to tumble, and we certainly see that. As to whether or not the things like tumble rate could be a factor, it certainly could be, but you'd have to know a fair amount about the aerodynamic properties, about the, you know, the geometry and other properties of the object to be able to determine that, I think.
Dr. Hubbard?
I'd like to pursue a little bit more of the question of how we might be able to determine the initiating event and distinguish that from the processes that may have happened post-breakup.
Mm-hmm.
In your experience, would you say that from directionality the deposition of molten materials or the way the surface had been worn away by heat, We could begin to separate the two. Would that be a fair characterization?
Certainly could be. I think if, for example, the orbiter was controllable for a good period of the time, and events that if evidence is found that would that could have occurred during that that period, and it is indicates a particular flow pattern or something like that, I think that could be very useful, absolutely. I think the early debris would be really critical to an analysis like that.
Mm-hmm. And even from the debris on the ground, if following the discussions
exactly.
about a ballistic entry of
right.
a steel strut, if it's worn away sort
right.
of equivalently versus something that shows that there's more deposition or thermal damage on one side than another, it might be a distinguishing characteristic.
It certainly could be. It certainly could be.
Okay.
Sir, based on your analysis of previous satellite reentries, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I'd make sure I understand it.
Mm-hmm.
Your suggestion there on your kind of your first view graph was that the typical reentry is that the process starts rather slowly, and little things come off. But then it reaches some catastrophic point where just everything flies apart.
Fills apart, right.
And that's, if I got it about
that, that's basically correct.
And,
major structural failure.
And that is not an unusual scenario. I mean, that doesn't indicate a design flaw or anything like that. It's just the aerodynamics and the heating of the thing reach a point where it can't tolerate it anymore.
Exactly. And basically when the process starts, in other words, the disintegration process starts, it is typified by not a violent event exactly, but we'll call it a catastrophic event where the spacecraft really comes apart into a number of portions. And then from that point on, an observer on the ground would essentially see a number of objects proceeding through the sky.
We've struggled, like everyone, with how do you separate out reentry heating from the event itself. And our plan is to really look hard at the differences between the right wing and the left wing. And
yes.
I would assume that you would agree that that's probably a good approach to
yes,
try and
very much.
Look at the differences between the two.
Yes, indeed, I would.
Yeah, Mr. Wallace.
In the civil aviation field where I usually work, we often have the challenge of differentiating damage that may have precipitated a failure event in the sky or damage that was sort of part of the failure sequence
mm-hmm.
Versus what was impact damage on the ground, often right. very critical distinctions to be made. And, of course, here we add in the thermal effects.
I mean, exactly.
What are your sort of thoughts on the basic method you can use to sort those things out?
Well, as you say, the challenge here is going to be that the heating itself is going to have the potential, at least, of masking the heating and loads as during the breakup process, and as an object comes down and continues to break up as it enters the atmosphere, is going to have this tendency to mask the initiating event, and that's going to be really the challenge here, and that's why I think that the effort really needs to be focusing on the early debris and on, as you say, the differences. If there are scenarios that would cause differences in some of the debris, that would be very useful to know about. And thirdly, to focus on surviving objects which can be traced back to areas of interest by one fashion or another.
Just, has there been anything generally in this in your observation of the Columbia debris distribution recovery process that has sort of surprised you?
Well, I've been pleasantly surprised by the efforts that's been made to really recover the debris pieces and get specific information on those things, the weights, latitude and longitudes of those, the amount of effort that's being put into it, I think is really not characteristic of these kinds of events and may be very useful. So I would say I've been very pleasantly surprised by that.
Dr. Ehler, the two most western pieces of debris that we've found have both been tiles.
Yes.
Either a fragment of a tile or an individual tile, not connected to any metal or any structure. But my understanding is you are suggesting then that a tile would have a relatively low ballistic coefficient.
Fine, sir.
And therefore the flight path is nearly vertical.
Certainly, ultimately, will be vertical, yes.
Well, what I mean is, compared to something with a high ballistic coefficient,
yes,
it's backtracking into space, then it would be safe to assume that, these things, these tiles came off relatively close to where they were found on the ground compared to a dense.
Yes, that's exactly right.
And the fact that in almost all the dense objects that we found a couple hundred miles downrange. What I'm trying to do is I'm trying to rationalize in my mind the dichotomy between something with a low ballistic coefficient that comes off late,
mm-hmm,
versus something with a high ballistic coefficient which comes off early, because you could have them found in reverse places on the ground.
Well, a lot of that will depend on the timing of the release, too. If you've got something that's released at a very high altitude, early in the reentry, and it has a very low ballistic coefficient, as you said, that object will, in essence, stop very quickly and flutter to the ground. It's complicated by the fact that if it was simply a tile that came off, that's one thing. But if it was actually bringing something else with it,
mm-hmm,
then there may be more going on there that other piece of material would have probably increased the ballistic coefficient a little bit, which have made, gone a little bit further down. As you saw from the footprint chart that I gave, where we had the multiple footprints there, the altitude and what the trajectory looks like as it begins to heal over there will really affect how things fly. But there can be low ballistic coefficient pieces that are released all through that process. And so some will be carried further because they're attached to heavier debris. Some will be released and then flutter to the ground. So as you move forward in time, the footprint becomes much more complicated.
Right. Another question is, you mentioned the ability of aluminum or the inability of aluminum to survive reentry for one reason or another. It either burns up, melts,
mm-hmm,
oxidizes,
right,
vaporizes. But
mm-hmm,
what is your experience with rubber? You know, we have found five of the six tires and maybe a fraction of the sixth. We're not exactly sure, but we found five of the six tires, two or three of which actually look like tires.
Mm-hmm. Well, in the first place, I've never seen a spacecraft come down with rubber on it before.
Well, we've never seen one with wheels either. But,
no, never have.
But you've never seen rubber in a debris, right?
I haven't. It would be, I'm sure someone could take a look and basically say if rubber experienced heating of this type, how would it be expected to respond? You know, some materials can be protected by the fact that they shed away external layers, for example, ablative materials that are used on spacecraft reentries typically. So it may have properties that would enable it to survive of that type.
Good. All right. Very good. This debris field that we have here, I think you're familiar, that we're talking about from just west of Dallas to just over the Louisiana border, which is,
mm-hmm,
about 375 miles or something like that. Do you have any reaction to, are you surprised it's that small or that big, or considering that the first shedding event that we know about was at about 225,000 miles. Actually, we're going to find that out here in about another 10
mm-hmm
minutes. But
220,000 feet, you mean?
Yeah, 225,000 feet, yeah, right,
mm-hmm,
exactly. Because you had a view graph up there that indicated in one of these reentry things, it was spread over 400 miles. So, what do you conclude from this one?
Well, that footprint I was talking about was from the piece that actually brushed the lady on the shoulder. Very low ballistic coefficient piece, probably less than one. So it was something just in fact did flutter down. To the fairly large objects, which were ballistic coefficients up around, I don't know, 70, 50, 60, something like that. So those are a reasonable range of ballistic coefficients. The size of the footprint here is about what you'd expect to see, I think.
Okay. All right. Board members? Yes. Mr. Wallace?
You were very complimentary of the amount of shoe leather that's gone into this,
right,
recovery effort.
Right.
Are there, I mean, do you expect that any further major breakthroughs or strokes of luck are more a matter of shoe leather, or are there calculation methods that you think might be further explored backtracking pieces you've found to
right. Well, a couple of things. First, I think the work that's going on relative to finding the debris is really an important part, and that really has to be emphasized. That's going to be a key to solving this puzzle, I believe. The second part would be to look at the debris field itself, but you have to have collected the debris in that field. So this idea of going out and finding these things, I imagine that pieces will continue to be found over a period of time, and they need to be cataloged and brought in and examined just as they are being now. But to really look for anything that's related to, as I was mentioning before, but possible scenarios, for example, the right wing versus left wing scenario and those kinds of things. So, I think that's the way it should go.
Scott, did you have another question?
Yes, one last question for me, at least. In looking at your observations in summary, mm-hmm. You bring up the concept of data fusion here. I wonder if you could elaborate on that a little bit. What do you really mean there?
Well, basically, the data fusion means that, for example, where we have videos that have been taken by private citizens, taking those videos, processing those things, we know the orbiter's trajectory very well during portions of the reentry. In a sense, fusing that data, so you take the video data, you marry it with the trajectory data, so you know exactly what you're looking at. You can use that information to help derive information about when objects are shed, where are these objects, what the timing is, what are the characteristics of those objects, things like we talked about ballistic coefficient, which you can estimate based on how fast something separates from the orbiter in a video, what the characteristics of that object are. And so that's what I mean by fusion, just taking all the existing data and bringing it all together so that you actually have a complete picture, as good as you can do with the data you've got, of what actually happened.
Would you include thermodynamic analysis, entry heating, in addition to these actual observations, empirical observations?
Yes, I think that's true, but the fusing I'm talking about really is more of a trajectory level, if you see what I mean.
Okay.
There's certainly other data. The data on the ground, for example, needs to be brought into this as well, and should be. So it's really a question of fusing the various data. I come out of the trajectory side of the house, so looking at data from where things happen in the trajectory, tracking them down, trying to derive information on the ground, and then really developing a best estimate of what actually happened is mm-hmm. what I'm speaking of.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. That leads to my last question, and that is, if you would make a value judgment for us on the accuracy and the efficacy of this reverse trajectory analysis kind of thing. In other words,
sure.
If we find something on the ground, how much effort and what value should we place on trying to predict the point in the sky where this thing became an independent an independent object? And if you would take a shot
sure.
at that.
That is going to be a real tough problem, quite frankly.
You mean because it's just not an accurate process?
It's not an accurate process. As I mentioned in my opening remarks, we don't have internal information from a spacecraft that's breaking up as to what exactly is happening with it. So modeling it down, doing computer models of the reentry and breakup of a spacecraft is a we recognize that there's uncertainty in there. The problem with taking debris on the ground and transferring it back up is you don't really know how it got here. There'll be debris on the ground that'll be surprising, very lightweight things that could, in a sense, burn very easily but may have actually survived and impacted the ground. Those objects we know were shielded, because they wouldn't have gotten there otherwise. They were shielded, but where it was originally in the vehicle, and then the scenario that it followed for shedding the various layers of material and the changes in the aerodynamic and mass properties of that host object as it came down through the atmosphere is going to be a very tough thing to derive. That's why I think that really a key here is to look at the early debris as closely as you can to really try to determine what really happened prior to a lot of that breakup process going on.
And, of course, it's probably a variable. Once again, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but, for example, if you were to tell me the ballistic coefficient of a sphere, a fuel sphere, I bet you could pin that ballistic coefficient down pretty well.
Exactly.
But if it was a piece of debris or a jagged-edged thing that was part tile, part metal, part strut, part bar, the ballistic coefficient might be a big, pretty big estimate.
And yes, in fact, again, the ballistic coefficient for what you actually find on the ground was different at 100, at say 75,000 feet or 100,000 feet or 120,000 feet. So the higher up you get, the bigger the change is. If you're talking about going backwards in time, so what you find on the ground is one thing, but trying to translate that back up and say, okay, well, we know it fractured off of something. What was that? We don't quite know what that was.
From a forensic point of view,
mm-hmm.
What are some of the most interesting observations that you can imagine making on the debris? And the second part of that is, does Aerospace Corporation have any metallurgic capabilities to help us analyze some of the observations we make on this debris?
We do have analyzed some of the debris in the past, and so we have some experience in doing this work. The kinds of things that, again, will be important to look for here are opportunities, if you want to call them that, for preserving some of the original events. And that could be where material is found, heat shield material or something like that is found from areas where it likely came off and protected some evidence of the original events, or that would be really critical. So I think it's going to be a question of looking for objects on the ground where it's likely that some of the original evidence from the original burning or fragmentation would be preserved, perhaps behind the wing leading edge or behind tiles, those kinds of things.
Thank you very much. Would you like to have the last word? Do you got any advice for us on how to solve this riddle, Dr. Hill?
No, it's certainly a tough problem, but I think the advantage here is that there's been so much interest by the public in actually helping to gather debris pieces. I think that's really to really be complimented. We typically don't see that kind of interest, and those debris pieces can really be essential in helping solve this puzzle. So I think that's been really a good thing.
Thank you very much. On behalf of the board, we thank you for your appearance here today and for summarizing what I know is a deeper and more exhaustive study into reentry physics and aerodynamics. We appreciate your efforts, and I want you to know that we've learned and we've learned from you, and we'll see if we can't solve this riddle with your help. Thank you very much.
Thank you, my pleasure.
The board will take about a 5-minute break while the next panel impanels itself and prepares. They have a considerable amount of visual aids and things like that, so we'll take about a 5-minute break, and we'll be right back in about 5 minutes.
Take it away. I need to do something about that. I got to stay in character.
One of the persons who had worked on some of these problems.
Oh, yeah, good.
I'm also experienced in deep
aerodynamics. Oh, great.
Nobel Laureate in physics.
Yes, of course. Wow, you're a student of Dr. Thomas. You could
give
us a cigarette. That's amazing.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Okay.
Who are the people who work in the Manhattan Project?
Yeah, great.
Okay.
I think the thing to do is send me an email. Okay. And my address is Sheila.
Here's my card.
Yeah. Sheila at MIT.
Okay.
.edu. And that's the way I like to work.
Yeah,
that's
MIT.
MIT.
.edu.
.edu, right.
Okay.
And that's a good way to get in touch.
Because there are things that I didn't have
a sure, I understand. Yeah, no, I understand. I get a lot of emails.
Most of them up in the center.
Yeah. Well, no, we're still waiting. I mean, it seems to take these people a long time to together. So we'll see what we get. We basically asked
in order.
For all
should be the last
possibly, FAA and the... NEXRAD and the air traffic control radars, and, you know, the Air Force, of course, given us some interesting stuff. So, you know, but I guess the reason, you know, you want to get it right the first time, right? So you want to take your time to pull it together.
Eric, we're showing shiny, sweaty forehead.
Do I care?
If you need
to look and feel your best.
So we're going to have more CPS.
All right. Please sit down. Get back to work. All right, board. We're privileged to have two people who've been studying this tragedy since the first day and know more about it than most other people. Mr. Paul Hill and Mr. Doug White. Gentlemen, before we start, I'm going to, we don't swear witnesses in, but we do ask them to affirm that they're going to tell the truth and the whole truth. So I will read a statement of affirmation to you and ask you to, if you agree with it, just say you will. So before we begin, let me first ask you to affirm that the information you provide to this board today will be accurate and complete to the best of your current knowledge and belief.
I will.
Yes, I will.
Thank you very much.
Gentlemen, we know that, we know you, but for the record, we'd like for you to introduce yourselves, say a few words about where you work and what your background is, and then we would be delighted to listen to as much of an opening statement as you'd like to make, as much as a briefing as you want to make. Paul, you want to go first?
Sure. My name's Paul Hill. I work in Mission Operations Director here. I'm a space shuttle and a space station flight director. I've been a flight director for about 7 years.
And you are currently... What are you doing for the MRT?
For the MRT, I run a team that's called the Early Sightings Assessment Team. And after Doug talks about the timeline, I'll go into great detail about what we do and how we do it. But the short answer is we're trying to make some sense out of the public imagery and any external sensor data we can get our hands on to tell us what was happening to us as early in entry as possible, and maybe shed as much engineering information as possible on what was going on with the vehicle before we knew it was happening on the ground.
Thank you very much, Doug.
Hi, my name is Doug White. I'm a Director of Operations Requirements for United Space Alliance. In my job, I'm responsible for turnaround test requirements at the Cape. I'm also responsible for anomaly resolution. I'm also responsible for the engineering support during missions. I do have the timeline to talk about today. As far as what I'm doing on the mission response team, I am on a team which we call the technical integration team, and basically our job is from a management perspective to try to pull together all the different efforts of the different teams, the aero, the thermal, the scenario teams, and try to make sense out of all the data and all the teams and try to bring a coherent story together.
Thank you very much. And which one of you is going to go first?
I think I'll go first.
Thank you.
And I plan to walk everyone through the timeline. If you could get to page 3 of my briefing, please. Okay. On page 3, this is showing a graphic showing the sensors that we're most interested in the left wing. Let's see. I haven't got it up yet. Yeah, if you could page down a couple pages, please. And there we go. This particular chart shows the sensors in the left wing. There are a number of sensors in the wheel well that we were interested in that we got data from that behaved in an off-nominal way. There were also sensors, temperature sensors out in the wing, some of which went offline, which was off-nominal, and some of which did stay online, which also tells us things that they were not affected. The different colored wires that you see represent the wiring runs for those particular sensors. The pink one is for sensors that were aft in the wing and runs forward past the wheel well and then ultimately into the mid-body. There were some sidewall temperature sensors, one of which has a yellow line coming from it that indicates the wire run for that particular sensor, which was inside the mid-body. There's also a green and a gray wire run you see in the back there that goes through a connector box and into the aft. The green wire run is for sensor data from those particular sensors indicated by green dots, and then the gray wire run is for a power cable. It's a little bit different than the sensor wires. This provided power to the actuators and came from a box there which is labeled ASA-4. That stands for Air Surface Servo Amplifier, and that basically provides electrical power and commanding to the actuators for the elevons on the back of the wing.
Doug, before we, yes. before we leave that, pardon me for interrupting, but to what degree is that a cartoon, and to what degree is that a fairly accurate representation of where the cables actually run?
It's kind of in between a cartoon and fairly accurate. For example, the pink wire does run exactly alongside the wheel well and does turn and go in front of the wheel well and then does run to a connector right forward of the wheel well, as is indicated there. So those are approximate locations of where those wire runs. Now in the back there, where you see the green, the gray, and the pink all together, those wires may actually be separated in space by 1 or 2 or 3 feet. This is looking down on the wing, and so you can't see the actual vertical separation between these wire runs. That just because they happen to show up on top of each other in the picture doesn't necessarily mean that they're bundled together within the vehicle.
And what's the little insert box?
Oh, I'm sorry, I forgot to mention that. That little insert is for some sensors that were forward on the orbiter. These are temperature sensors on a supply water dump nozzle, which is a nozzle used to dump excess water overboard. Right below that is temperature sensors for the wastewater dump nozzle, again used to dump wastewater overboard. And then there's another one forward, which is called the vacuum vent dump nozzle. And those sensors also gave us some off-nominal readings, and since they were too far forward to show in this scale, we just put them in as a little inset.
Thank you. May we interrupt them?
Yeah. Just to follow up on Admiral Gaiman's first question, are the orbiters different? Are there variances in the actual location of the wires among the orbiters?
There may be slight differences between 102, since it was the first one built. 102 had a lot of wiring, which was called development flight instrumentation, a lot of wiring for that. During its most recent major modification period, we removed a lot of that wiring. Some of it we just left in place, so the wiring on 102 was substantially different than the substantially different in the DFI aspect, but for the sensor wiring,
DFI.
It was pretty much the same.
Developmental Flight Instrumentation, DFI?
DFI, Developmental Flight Instrumentation.
I'm the acronym police here.
Let me continue with the wire questioning. We do know that there were actually four cable runs running back aft that went around the wheel well compartment, one on top of the other. Are all of those sensors that you shows going off in one of those runs, or in all of those runs, or some portion in each of those runs?
All of the ones in the pink are all within one particular cable. We don't have the specifics about whether or not for a particular part of run, any one of the wires was like at the back of that bundle or on the top of that bundle. There are also more.
You're not answering. Yeah. The question is, as I look inside the shuttle wheel well door and look up, there are four wire bundles that run aft.
All of the ones in the pink wire are in a single bundle.
And are the red ones in that same bundle? The ones that went off in the aft end of the
Yes, wing. All of the ones that went off in
so
the aft
So everything that went off are in one single bundle.
Yes. There are also many other wires, though, in that bundle for which we do not have data.
Understood.
Okay.
Do we know if that's the top bundle or the middle bundle or the lower bundle?
If I remember the picture right, it's the upper one.
Thank you.
Right. But that we'll find that out.
Yeah, and I can give you the more exact answer. I'm just trying to remember it off the top of my head now.
We'll go back to the diagram, to the blueprints, and find that out. Okay, please continue. Thank you.
All right, so this, go to the next slide, please. This particular time is about 7.5 minutes before our loss of signal at a GMT of 1352, and all of our sensors appeared nominal. This time, go to the next slide, please. Now this slide, we didn't show any sensors going offline, but we put this in the timeline. This particular time, 1352.05, is the first indication that we had something off nominal from an aerodynamic standpoint. We were able to derive aerodynamic coefficients in yaw and roll, which showed us that we were flying differently than we had expected to. You're going to hear a lot more about that tomorrow, but basically the way we have done that is to look at the way we should have been flying, look at the way we actually were flying, and take the difference between the two and come out with some moments on the vehicle, both in the yaw and the roll. This particular off-nominal event, it started first in the yaw component. So we're seeing a different yaw here at this point in time than we expected to see. Next slide, please. This is our first sensor that we saw with a small rise and a I want to stress that this was a very small...
Excuse me for interrupting again. I think if it's okay with you, we'll talk about these things while you bring them up.
All right, that's fine.
This off-nominal measurement, which we'll talk about tomorrow when we're talking about aerodynamics and thermodynamics, but just to... I want to get to the level of detail that you and your team have been going to. I mean, you didn't realize this until about Rev 12 or Rev 10. Could you tell me when this became apparent to you?
Well, fairly early on, the aerodynamic guys knew that we had differences in the flight control from what we would have normally seen. They looked at the aileron, and the aileron was behaving differently and continued to behave differently throughout the entry. It took a while before we could back out that particular moment in time that we just went through there was the very first indication that this derived yaw delta was first affecting us at that point in time. But fairly early on, we were able to see some of the larger flight control responses that were off nominal tests.
Okay. And I could look it up here, but you may be able to tell me, we are at approximately what altitude and what speed here?
I don't have those numbers. There are versions of this that do have all those numbers on there. I guess I could look it up, too. I have some notes here.
But we are approximately 235,000 feet.
That's about right.
Right. And, okay, please go
all
ahead
right
and resume.
All right, this is the first sensor that went offline. This is a left main gear brake line temperature D. It began a very slow rise. We call it a bit flip, which is essentially one bit in the data stream showed that it was rising. And we believe this is the first indication that there was an off-nominal event and something was going on with the orbiter inside that was causing that measurement to rise. Going on to the next page. These are the supply water dump nozzles A and B that I talked about. There are three nozzles to the forward there, the supply water dump, the vacuum vent dump, which is the very forward one, and the wastewater dump, which is actually below the supply water dump. These nozzle temperatures A and B both began an off-nominal rise rate. If you look at the graphs, you'll see a very small knee in the graph where the two sensors are rising at a particular rate, and then there's a bend where they start rising at a faster rate, and this continues for about 15 seconds or so, and then it bends back over and starts rising at the same rate that it had been before at the nominal rate.
But this picture gives you no, this picture doesn't tell you where that is, does it?
Well, again, that's why it was an inset.
Right.
They're very far forward on the orbiter.
Forward on the
just right at the beginning of the wing, that little diagonal you see there is the very beginning of the wing chine, and they're just aft of the crew module portion of the vehicle.
On the top, right?
They're on the sidewall. Sorry. We're just showing them on the top for visibility, but they're actually both on the sidewall just above the wing.
Now, this anomaly is in a completely different place, as you say, well forward. Is there anything that would lead you to believe that this is in fact a sensor malfunction, you know, something wrong with the box, the electronics box, as opposed to...
It does not appear to be. We don't know of a failure scenario that would explain this as a sensor malfunction. We think it is real data showing us there was a change. Now, whether or not the change that caused these temperatures to rise is related to what ultimately caused our tragedy, we don't know. They may be connected, they may not. So we're including this in our data, and we'll continue to look at it until we can explain it.
Yeah. Okay, so you're including that this is real data from everything you know. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Dr. Whitnell?
How anomalous was this anomaly? Have you looked at early shuttle flights to see if you had such
for this
effect?
Particular measurement, we did look at every single mission, and every single mission, these vent nozzle temperatures rise at a very straight, steady rate. So this is an anomaly in that the rate changed, but it was very short duration, about 15 seconds or so, that they were rising at a higher rate, and after that, they went back to their same nominal rate. So whatever caused them to rise at this higher rate was a transient, at least locally transient event.
And this, I'm just stating the obvious here for Paul, though. obviously, this is pre-video here. We're out over the ocean.
This is out over the ocean. If you notice in the lower left there, there's a ground track trying to show approximately where we were with regards to the ground track,
so
and we're still
well
off
the coast.
If something
was going on, we have no video of it.
Right.
We're within a few minutes of having our first video when we see this.
Right. All right, if you go on to the next slide. And this is the vacuum vent. Just a few seconds later, it began its rise as well. Go on to the next slide. Now we're back into the wheel well. And this is the left main gear brake line temperature A. This is down on the strut for the landing gear. And it began a very slow rise again. All of the temperatures in the wheel well at first exhibited a very slow rise rate. It wasn't until about 2 minutes from now in the timeline that they began a much more rapid rise rate.
Can you, we're both trying to do the same thing here. We're trying to characterize the heat in the wheel well.
Yes.
Can you describe to me exactly where the sensor is? Is it inside a block that's measuring the hydraulic fluid temperature, or is it up against the block where the sensor is out?
This particular one is on the hydraulic line that's on the strut. So it does have some exposure
to ambient,
fairly good exposure to the atmosphere
in
the wheel well.
So it's not buried inside a great big block or something like that?
That particular one is not, but you know, there is a heat sink of the actual strut itself, and that provides some heat sink. Some of the temp sensors down on the wheel, you have the heat sink of the wheel itself. Many of the temp sensors that you see lined up four in a row there that are on the sidewall, some of those are actually under epoxy covers, and so would not have a very good exposure to radiation or convective heating.
But this one?
This particular one would have a fairly good exposure.
Thank you.
All right, the next slide, please. And this is back on the sidewall again. This is the left main gear brake line temp C. Again, a very beginning, a very slow rise. Next slide, please. All right, now we start to see things going on in the wing, and we believe this is directly related to some sort of burning or disintegration of that pink wire run that's affecting these sensors. The reason we believe that is because some of the other sensors nearby them don't show any effects, and these sensors do start to show effects, so we think it's happening away from where those sensors are. It's shown not completely colored in as offline. These sensors, we've done some testing that when you burn through the wire, you end up with a variable shorting, a variable resistance in the wire, and you start to see the sensor kind of trail off in time. It doesn't immediately just go to its off-scale low reading. So this particular sensor at this time began to trend down. Next slide, please. And then a few seconds later, that sensor was completely offline. Next slide, please. All right, here's another indication that we put in the timeline of another off-nominal aero event. This is the first clear indication. We mentioned before that we had the yaw, derived yaw moment showing us we're off-nominal. At this point, we began to have an off-nominal roll component to the aerodynamics. Next slide, please. Again, this is another sensor in the wing which began to trend down. This is the hydraulic system one left inboard elevon actuator return line temperature, and it began its movement downwards. Then the hydraulic, next slide please, hydraulic system three on the left outboard elevon also began to go down.
Let us ask a question.
Sure.
Yeah, just clarification as we go here. The ones that you feel fairly certain are showing the actual wire damage, have you been able to back up and reconstruct in the wire bundle what was where?
No, that's one of the things that we don't know. The drawings are not specific enough to allow you to reconstruct which wire might have been on the outside of the bundle, if you will, which wire might have been farther back in the bundle, which wire might have been right in the center. We don't have that level of detail to know which what the placement of each single wire was within its larger bundle.
Okay, is there a hope of reconstructing that from closeout photos or as-built drawings or anything, or is that pretty much
no? We will not be able to reconstruct that.
Right. Okay. Thank you.
Are the wire bundles themselves encapsulated or covered, other than the individual wires being covered?
Individual wires. Sometimes you have like twisted shielded pairs. You have shielding around those. But then once you make a larger wire bundle, no, the wires themselves are not covered with any kind of insulation. We do, for a lot of our wire runs, put convoluted tubing around that black crenellated tubing that provides some impact resistance for people working around the wire. That's made out of a Teflon-like material and provides some impact resistance, but wasn't designed to provide any kind of a thermal barrier or anything like that. Yes, sir.
As you're talking about all the wire here, all of this wire that you are talking about, it is all Kapton wire, is that correct?
Yes, this is all Kapton covered wire, yes.
Thank you.
All right, we'll go to the next slide. This is hydraulic system 3 left outboard Elevon actuator return line temp that actually finally went offline. As I said, it had begun. It takes a few seconds for these things to go down. Some of the ones that we'll show you a little bit later actually took quite a while to go offline, which indicates to us that maybe they were shorting or that part of the wire was burning through more slowly at that point. Next slide, please. This is back to the system one on the inboard. That one has now gone offline. Next one. This is hydraulic system one on the left outboard. That particular sensor has now gone offline. And again, as I said before, the reason we believe that the damage is occurring away from the actual location of the sensor is because you see that green dot right next to it, and that particular sensor was not reading anything off nominal at that particular time. So whatever was causing the damage was happening somewhere else. Next slide, please. This is back to hydraulic system 2, left inboard Elevon actuator. Return line temperature again started its slow change to going offline. Next slide, please. Now we go back forward, and you notice that our supply water dump nozzles have now come back to their nominal rise rate. So whatever effect was going on up front is now not there anymore, and the supply water dump temperatures are back to their they're still increasing, but that's nominal the way they've been for every other flight. And next slide, please. And then also the vacuum vent nozzle also went at the same time, went back to nominal. And you can see at this point we're just now crossing the California coast and just about to pick up video, which Paul will talk to you about in a moment. Next slide, please.
Doug,
yes.
The sensors back by the Elevons, all of them back there. I've got the same thing in front of me here that you have. And for the people in the audience, there's a timeline. There's a little sliding scale across the top of the view graph up there.
Right.
See where we're going. But the first sensor, I'm talking about just the sensors that dropped off scale low.
Mm-hmm.
The first one is 52.56, and then the one you just before this you said was 53.35.
Mm-hmm.
So essentially, that scenario that you just went through, where these 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 sensors, that happened in 40 seconds. That took 40 about my arithmetic. It took about 40 seconds.
Right.
That little scenario just went through. If we assume that you're right, that the wires were either melted or the insulation of the wires were melted and they shorted to each other or shorted to ground or opened.
Right.
And by the way, you should be able to tell us that, right?
Well, again, we have done testing so far to where we took a we're planning on doing more tests to get more representative case, but we took a wire bundle, we attached sensors to the end of it, we put a torch on it, and we looked at the characteristics of the sensors going offline, and they do look similar to what we saw in the vehicle. We do see them begin to do a slow decline, and then they eventually go off scale low.
Right. So just for my mental picture then, this little scenario that whatever happened in that wire bundle took about 40 seconds, according to my arithmetic.
Yes. Right. Okay, next slide.
Excuse me here.
Yes.
Before we continue, could you explain the physical, the void that is the wing? Is it possible, for example, for air to flow freely in there? Is it a sealed compartment? Could you kind of explain that as
open.
Looking at the sensors in particular?
Yeah, let me see if I can explain a little bit. If you see the panels all along the edge there of the wing, those are the reinforced carbon-carbon panels or RCC panels. Behind them is an aluminum spar that runs all the way down the length of the wing. If you see the the vertical lines, those are solid aluminum spars with some cutouts through them so that would allow a vent passage, if you will. There's one main vent passage pretty much where the pink wire runs, which is how you get through the spars. The horizontal lines are representative of rows of borne aluminum struts, which are basically tubes that are there for reinforcing the structure of the wing. And so that area from up and down on this slide here would be all open, but at each one of the spars, which are those vertical lines, you're closed out except for some small openings.
And the wheel well?
The wheel well is completely enclosed from the rest of the wing. There is a hole in the very front of the wheel well that's about 5 inches in diameter, which would allow some flow into there. There are some other drain holes and some small openings around some of the hinge covers, which would allow a very small amount of flow out. The square area of the hole into the wheel well in the front is about 19 square inches. The remaining holes altogether total less than 1 square inch.
So on the forward bulkhead of the wheel well, there's a hole with a screen or a
screen. Yes, it does have a screen on it.
Which allows kind of free communication into this, what we call the glove area.
That is correct, yes.
So it's safe to say then that an air molecule, once inside the wing, is pretty much free to flow around the inside of the wing through the very
through the vent passages, right? Also, there's another hole between the wing glove area and the midbody that's forward about where that yellow arrow is. There's another hole into the midbody there, which is rather large. That particular hole is about 146 square inches.
Dr. Woodnall has a question, too.
What is the material that the wheel well structure is made out of?
It's made out of aluminum honeycomb.
How thick is it?
I do not know the thickness. We can get that for you.
Okay, but it's basically a thin piece with a honeycomb and another piece?
It's right, a thin face sheet, some honeycomb material, and another face sheet. Yes. All right, next slide, please. All right, we've annotated the debris events. We are over California now, and you'll see in the videos that from the public, we were starting to see debris being shed from the orbiter. This is the first one that we've seen in any of the videos that have been provided to us, and we called it debris number one. And the timing on that, you notice, is plus or minus 2 seconds, which is about the best we can resolve from the video. Next slide, please. We have debris number two, and next slide, debris number three. It's all coming off relatively rapidly. Next slide, please. Let's see, there's three. Next slide. And you notice with the little time hack up at the top there, we started to put triangles below the line for the debris events. The diamonds along the line there are for the off-nominal sensor readings, and then the two triangles on the top of the line are for the aerodynamic readings. So that's kind of how you read that little graph up at the top. So next slide, please. There's the fifth debris, and next slide. Okay, now we start to see another temperature rise in the wheel well. This is, again, also on the strut. Also should have some fairly good communication with the flow of whatever's happening in there. This is left main gear brake line temperature B.
Can I ask a question about that? Because this one is probably the most confusing sensor to me personally. Line temperature A went off, and I noticed that you appear to have changed the timing on this a little bit, went off about a minute sooner than this. Line temperature A and B are about, the sensors are about 2 inches apart.
That's correct.
At the same time, you have D and C, which have gone, which are significantly gone off already early, significantly separated both in the X, Y, and Z dimension, which would tend to suggest that the entire wheel well compartment is warm. Why do you see this big, huge time lapse between A and B, which are separated by 2 inches? Is there any explanation that you all have come up with, or at least theory, on why there's this big separation in time?
Right now, we do not know of a good theory that holds together that says why one would show the rise and not the other. Again, at about this time, well, about this time now, they're starting to, the rises are starting to become significant. So we don't have a good theory. It may be the amount of heat sink, the way it was attached to the strut itself that provided some more resistance to temperature rise. We really don't have a good theory right now for why 1-2 inches away was rise earlier than another one.
And it's significant in terms of the time. I mean, a minute in this
yes.
entire time frame is a virtual eternity.
Yes. One possible explanation that we've been kicking around is the fact that whatever the event is that is causing heating in the wheel well might not be constant in the sense that it's continuing to direct flow into the wheel well. Perhaps we were directing flow in at one point in time and through the dynamics of the vehicle, through the evolving change in the damage to the vehicle, that the flow was redirected to some other part of the wing for a time and then came back.
You're talking about the equivalent of a runaway fire hose kind of thing.
Something like that, yeah. I wouldn't describe it quite that way, but yes, something like that, where if you had some sort of a plume heating into the wing, that maybe it was pointing one direction first and then another and then back again, yes.
Dr. Woodnell?
You know, given the extensive damage that has already occurred to the vehicle at this early time, I guess I question the use of the word early debris. I guess from my point of view, I would call them mid-debris.
Well,
it's clear to me from the timeline that things must have fallen off in the ocean well before
We don't know,
obviously.
Right. We don't have any evidence of that. These are the first debris events that we see, so we just started at one.
But at this point, you've already got some kind of hole in the vehicle. You've got a wire bundle that's either completely burned through or burning through. You're starting to pick up what I interpret as flow inside the wing. So clearly some structural damage has already taken place by whatever mechanism.
Right. We do believe that we had structural damage somehow at this point in time that was allowing flow into the wing. Whether or not we had shed any debris out over the ocean earlier, we can't say one way or the other. It would be speculation.
Yeah. We call them early debris to distinguish it from the actual spacecraft breakup
over
Texas.
I understand that.
Doug, in your machine here, you don't have the sister view graph.
I do, but they told me they could only project one at once. But if you want to see the other one, you're talking about for the vertical elevations between these? Yes.
If you could do one of them.
Okay.
I don't know if you could do the companion to this one or not.
Well, it's if they want to go ahead and bring it up, it's called part two. And,
let's not do that.
Okay, we could do that. I think they only have the capability to show one at once.
Right. Okay.
All right, let's go on to the next slide. All right, here, this is, you asked about how early we were able to see things. This started the slow aileron trim change. Again, I put the triangle up on top of the line there. This was one of the early aerodynamic things that we noticed. The two events that we talked about earlier took some time for us to back out and reconstruct. But from examining the data shortly after the accident, this was one of the things that we noted pretty early in the data. So this is another aerodynamic event that's off nominal. We started to see a slow trim change in the aileron. The aileron is basically, there is no, in the orbiter, there is no real physical aileron like you might have in an airplane. The aileron is a theoretical difference between the elevon position on one side of the vehicle and the elevon position on the other side of the vehicle. And so by adjusting the elevon, the relative different positions between those, you can create an aileron effect. And so that aileron effect was keeping the vehicle flying the way we wanted it to. So as the forces began to change on the vehicle, that trim changed, and we saw that in the data.
Doug, I just want to check and see that we're working from the same timeline here. This is what I've got is what's called Rev 15.
Yes, this should be Rev 15.
Okay, now you've skipped past the what are labeled unexpected comm dropouts. Is that because they're not part of the temperature sensor story, or
yeah, this particular and when I was coming here today and preparing for this, it was a question myself whether I should brief from the timeline that has every single event in it, or I should brief from this more graphical presentation, which did leave some of the events out. This particular graphical presentation does not have every single event like some of the comm dropouts. To this point, we've already had numerous comm dropouts that we consider anomalous. We just did not model those in this particular graphical presentation.
Okay, but so I guess the follow-up question to that is, where are the avionics boxes or the antennas or whatever associated with those, and can you make any connection between this set of anomalies and the comm dropouts?
Well, we are trying to do that. We're trying to create an entire picture where we can explain events that would affect everything that we see. So comm dropouts would be one of the things that we would try to explain. As for the location, the actual avionics boxes, they're in the avionics bays, which are forward in the crew module, and the antennas are in the crew module region on the top and the bottom of the vehicle, both.
Okay, so,
so they're well forward of this area where we're seeing the heating. But that's not to say whether or not some disturbance in the hot gas flow around the vehicle may or may not create a situation that would cause the comm to drop out. We were at fairly good look angles between us and the satellite, so we should have had good communication in this region. We have looked at past flights, and we did have good communication in these regions. So again, that's why we consider some of these comm dropouts as anomalous events.
Have you seen any relationship to the comm dropout in a debris event?
I'd have to look at the timing that that says how close one was to the other, but I don't believe we have been able to link any of those very closely.
There are debris events that are within seconds of some of the comm dropouts. It doesn't necessarily tell you they're related, but there are debris shedding events in this same time frame.
Okay, so the set of charts here, Rev 15, just looking quickly through them, since you're not going to cover these, I see up through comm event 14. How many of those are there?
Well, let's see here. Let me get my other version of the timeline. We had at 1352.09 through 1352, well, let's back up. 1350.00 through 1350.43, we had five periods of comm dropout from 1 to 6 seconds each. 1352.09 to 1352.55, there were four periods, again, from 1 to 6 seconds each. That would cover events 6 through 9. Then again, 1353.32 through 1354.22. Which would be right in this period here. There were two more periods. One was 2 seconds, one was 8 seconds. Those would be comm events 10 and 11. And there's some more events 12 and 13 that are down in the 55, 56 time frame. And comm event 14 was down at 1356, 55.
Okay, so can we expect to see some point in the near future composite plot or a plot like this that shows the antenna wire, the antenna, where the avionics is and so forth, and kind of be able to put it together?
Well, the scale we could probably do on a separate page just because of the scale, but yes, we could go ahead and do some kind of a graphical representation of that. Again, we don't see anything anomalous in the behavior of the comm system other than the comm wasn't getting through to the ground,
so
there may not have been anything physical going on within the orbiter itself at that location on the vehicle.
Could have been some interference between the orbiter and the receiving station.
Yes, it could have been, again, as I said, some kind of disturbance in the hot gas around the vehicle at that time, possibly.
Okay, thank you. We'll, I'm sure, be pursuing this further.
I'd like to bring up a question about Dr. Whitnall's statement about perhaps earlier debris which was not witnessed. Can you kind of put it in context when we saw heat onset and also the beginning of peak heating?
Let's see here. Let me look at my really detailed timeline and should the event times for that. Let's see, the beginning of entry interface, which is about 400,000 feet, is 1344.09. Let's see, the start of peak heating is at
50.
50, just about 50.
50, okay, yeah, thank you.
Right. And the reason I ask that is to underscore her statement that there could have been things that weren't witnessed because you are starting to experience heat before we started seeing these.
Right. There could have been, yes.
Sheila, do you have a question?
Yeah, I did have a question. I was about the calm. I think very interested in the calm. Is that anomalous for the whole range of shuttle missions? This loss of calm?
Yes, for this particular period, we have called these losses of calm anomalous events. We've compared them to other flights of Columbia on similar trajectories, and we believe we should, again, because of the look angles and where we were, we believe we should have had good calm in this period.
So it wasn't just a simple matter of shielding by the vehicle of some antenna. I mean, you've already dismissed that possibility.
Yes, we've looked at that, and we truly believe there's something anomalous going on here. Now, what it was and how to describe it, the effect, we're not sure of how to do that yet. We're still working on it. But, yes, we do believe that the calm dropouts in this period were anomalous. Yes.
Admiral Turcotte?
This is one of the first aerodynamic events that you've indicated here, and I'm guessing or interpolating here roughly we're in the 220s, probably lower Mach 20s. What kind of dynamic pressure is the airfoil experiencing at this point?
Again, I don't have those numbers in front of me. There are versions of this that have that on
50.
Here. Okay, thank you.
But in,
I was going to go look
it up
in my notes there.
If you were to put that in layman's terms, we're looking in, say, around 120 knots or something like that, or of
less.
Maybe
the Q-bar. The Q-bar was 29 PSF.
Okay, that's pounds
29.
Per square foot.
So probably roughly 80 knots, something like that.
And the Mach was 22.7.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So do you use PSF to go to knots?
Yeah, Q-bar is in pounds per square foot.
Yeah, I know that. But when you're doing your conversion to knots, you don't use PSI?
No, sir. PSF.
Yeah, PSF. Okay. So something like 75 or 80 knots of airspeed.
Okay.
Something like that. And the stagnation temperature now is 28.50, so we're at peak heating here.
Yes, we're in, yes, very high heating at this time.
But I think the point is that there is not 10,000 knots of air blowing past this vehicle.
Right. We're at a very low dynamic pressure at this region.
Very low dynamic pressure. So,
right. Mm-hmm. Lots of heat, but very low dynamic pressure.
And things are falling off.
That is correct.
Mm-hmm. Derek, go ahead.
All right, let's see, this is 5420, back up. I got lost in my own charts here from...
5422.
Yeah, okay, so let's go on to the next one then.
Yep.
This is another temperature. This is on the left main gear strut actuator temperature. Can I have the next slide up on the screen? Oops, I'm off by one here. 5422, okay. This is a sidewall temperature. This is the left aft fuselage sidewall temperature. Now, this particular temperature is about where it's indicated there on the aft sidewall, almost at the end of the wing. This is another indication that something going on externally in the flow above the wing is causing us heating up on the sidewall that far aft.
Now would you attribute this more to external heating rather than internal heating, is it?
Yes, I would. We have done some calculations, though, that say you could theoretically get enough flow or heating internally to cause this to rise. We have shown, though, that externally, if you were just missing the blankets, you wouldn't have enough heat to cause the temperature to rise. But theoretically, it would be possible. We've done some numbers and said you could have had heating from internal. It's also possible.
Is this sensor right underneath the blanket? Underneath the blanket?
Yes, this is on the skin, right under.
On the skin, right underneath.
Underneath the blanket. Yes, sir.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Okay, next slide. Okay, now we're back to the left main gear strut actuator temperature. This particular temperature is on a strut. When the gear goes down, that supports and braces the gear. And again, this one saw a rise. And again, you also notice, as you mentioned earlier, there are other sensors in the neighborhood that are still showing nominal at this point. Okay, next slide. Flash 1, this triangle is below the line there. This is another debris event. We saw a brightening of the orbiter image on the video, which occurred in where the orbiter was, and then as the orbiter moved away, this flash tended to persist in the trail that was showing behind the orbiter. Debris number 6, next slide please. Debris number 6 is the sixth piece of debris that we've been able to observe in the video. This one I used a larger triangle to indicate that this was a relatively significant piece of debris compared to the other ones. Debris number 6 and debris number 14 from the video that we have appear to be the largest and the brightest debris.
Yeah. Al?
Yes, I'm sorry.
Could you back up one?
Yes.
Do you have an explanation for flash number 1?
We think flash number 1 is attributed to debris 6 actually separating from the vehicle. We just don't see debris 6 as a separate object until a few seconds later. We really do think this is the initial event as that object came off the vehicle, crossed through the plasma wake and the shock wave.
But we're going to get a chance to talk about that.
Yeah, right.
On Paul's turn.
Okay, let's see. Debris number 6 was right after that. And next slide, please. All right, now we start to see some temperatures on the wheels themselves. These temperature measurements are down on the body of the wheel. And this is the first one of these that we started to see with a little bit of a rise. Again, we noted there was 2 bits, so it was a very, very small increase in the temperature of the wheel. Next slide. Debris number 7, and again, we're over Nevada. Next slide. All right, another temperature measurement on the sidewall of the wheel well. This is system 3, left-hand forward brake switching valve, return line temperature. Next slide. Debris number 8, approaching the Utah border. Next slide. Debris number 9. Next slide. Debris number 10, these all come off relatively close to each other. Next slide, debris number 11.
And you're going Mach 22 at this time with a Q bar of about 35 PSF.
Okay. Thank you. Next slide, please. This is another temperature on the sidewall. This particular one is on the sill, which is actually the top of the wall. It would be underneath the payload bay as the payload bay door comes up and over. This particular temperature would be sitting about right here under just under the door on the top of the sidewall. So we're getting getting some more heating up there. Again, this leads us to believe that we had something going on with the external flow that was causing higher than normal heating above the wing in this region.
At this point, the orbiter is flying with its right wing down, left wing up.
Yes.
Yes. Yes, it is. Right. Hasn't done its roll reversal.
Hasn't done the roll reversal, yes.
So these are left fuselage measurements here. That
yes, they are on the left side. Right.
Left side of the body. Is there any, is there a hotter side or a cooler side? I know the bottom heating is all uniform, but is there any reason aerodynamically or thermally to account for the left side being warmer? In other words, should I read anything into it? Would you expect the left side to be cooler at this particular kind of side since it's up and away from the...
Well, I think you really need to ask the thermal guys tomorrow, but...
Okay, good. You're right.
Yeah, generally from what they've told us that it should be about the same and that we believe these rises here were from some off-anomal event causing more heating on the left-hand side. But as compared on a normal entry versus one roll reversal compared to another roll reversal, I really can't comment on the relative
slight
differences you might see in temperature.
Yeah, we'll pursue that tomorrow.
Let's see. Next slide, please. This is debris number 12, and we're just crossing the Arizona border. Next slide, debris number 13. And debris number 14, next slide. This, again, is a very large debris relative to the other debris events, and so we showed the triangles a little bit larger at this time.
And so it's debris number 6 and 14 we want to pay attention to.
Right, and Paul's going to talk to you about that, about our efforts to try to track debris number 6 and 14 and see if we can figure out a footprint and perhaps recover those debris. All right, next slide, please. Now we're back to, we lost those five wing temperature measurements early on, and now we're starting to lose some more. This particular one is the left lower wing skin temperature. This measurement is on the lower wing skin itself, right on the bottom side of the vehicle. This one is starting to, this decline, and as you'll notice, these took quite a bit more time to go offline than the previous five that did go offline.
Now, these five that went off earlier, I can't tell from the color code whether or not they are in the same...
Yes, they are in the same wire bundle as the five that went off
earlier.
They're
in the same wire bundle,
yes.
But they're not on the same circuit or anything. I mean, it kind of shows like they're all pink or something, but they actually are different, aren't they?
Yes, each one of these sensors would have its own wire within the wire bundle.
Okay.
Yes.
Right. So we should not read anything into the fact that there's a difference between these five going and these two here. I mean, they're just different wires in the
different
same
wires bundle. Within the same bundle. Yes, sir.
Okay.
And you know, I was talking about twisted shielded pairs earlier. These wires for each one of these sensors is actually, if I remember right, a triplet of wires, which is then encased in Kapton, and then that particular wire that's formed from the triplet is one wire of many in the larger bundle. Okay, next slide, please. All right, this is debris number 15. And next slide, please. Now we have another wheel well temperature. This is a left main gear uplock actuator temperature. This is the actuator that holds the gear and the lock for the gear locked in the up position. Again, we're seeing an off-nominal temperature rise there. Also notice that there's another sensor on the sidewall. We've colored it orange, which means its temperature rise now has exceeded 15 degrees from what we would consider nominal. So the temperature on the sidewall continues to increase. Next slide, please. Now there's another skin temperature. This one happens to be the upper wing skin temperature is approximately above the one on the lower, but on the upper surface of the wing, and this one is starting to go offline. You also notice that the lower one hasn't quite failed all the way completely yet by this point in time. Next slide, please.
Excuse me. Now what should we read into the fact now that on your cartoon here, every sensor on this line here has now failed? Are there other wires in that bundle?
There are many other wires in the bundle.
In
the same bundle, yes, sir. These are the only, on that particular bundle, that pink, that we've indicated in pink there, those are the only ones that we have data for. The other wires in the bundle are either not used anymore because they were development flight instrumentation, which we're no longer using, or there are a series of instruments that are recorded on what we call our orbiter experiment recorder, which records measurements, and then we dump the tape when we get it to the ground and look at the values for that, but they're not available to us in real time. One of the things we've been hoping to find in the debris is that recorder to see whether or not any of the tape survived that may give us some of the data that tell us how other measurements in this area were faring at this time, and so we can learn more about the event.
Could you estimate how many of those sensors there are in there?
I went and got the number once for somebody. I do not remember the exact number off the top of my head.
Dozens more?
It's on the order of a dozen or so. Yes,
yeah.
Sir.
Okay. Thank you very much.
All right. Next slide, please. Okay. This is debris number 16. This is a debris event that was picked up in the Kirtland video. I'm sure everybody's heard about a video shot by some of the folks at Kirtland Air Force Base, and we were able to see a debris event from that particular video. Next slide, please. All right, this is the main landing gear back on the tires again and on the wheel. The main landing gear left-hand outboard tire pressure number 2, it's starting to show a little bit of an increase, only one bit.
Could we back up just a second here? I think for the timeline, we need to determine when the role reversal was. Because I think it happens right about...
56:55,
about 30 seconds ago, we did the role reversal, I think.
That's correct, yes.
We started 56:30 and finished at 56:55.
Right, 56:32.
So the role reversal is now complete.
Yes.
Right.
That's the complete of the first role reversal.
Now the left wing is down.
Right.
Okay. People keep telling me that doesn't make any difference in coordinated flight, but...
Okay.
I'm too dense to understand.
All right. Next slide, please. All right. This is the lower wing skin temperature finally completes its descent down to off-scale low. It did take a little longer than the first five. And again, to us, it just indicates that the rate of burning or the rate of shorting of that particular wire was different than the first five. Again, possibly indicative that whatever was causing the burning was changing direction or heat rates or something like that. Next slide, please. And then the upper wing skin temperature follows that shortly. Next slide, please. Now we start to see finally the last of the hydraulic measurements in the wheel well start to go up. And you can notice some of the other measurements have now turned orange, again indicating that they are continuing to rise and have gone more than 15 degrees above what we would consider nominal for this particular point in the flight. Next slide, please. This is what we're calling Flare 1. This is another event that we've observed out of the video taken at Kirtland Air Force Base. We see an asymmetrical brightening of the shape in the video. You can see one side of the orbiter image get brighter than the other side.
Which side?
It appears to us to be the left side. Next slide, please. And then flare 2, again, you see another little bit of a flare, again, apparently from the left side. Next slide, please. This is another aerodynamic event that we put in here graphically. This is the start of the sharp aileron trim increase. Remember, we've been doing a slow aileron trim increase, trying to keep the vehicle flying the way we want it to fly, trying to make it respond. At this point, there is some event that happens that causes the aerodynamic forces to require a much greater trim on the aileron. And so the trim begins increasing very rapidly here. And again, you'll have some charts tomorrow when the aerodynamics guys talk to just show you how rapidly that aerodynamic set of forces was increasing. Next slide, please. We're also seeing an increase now in the derived rolling and yawing moments. Those moments I told you that we were able to back out way up early that showed something off nominal. Again, the slopes of these moments are starting to change substantially at this point. Next slide, please. This is on the tire itself. This is main landing gear, left-hand tire pressure number one. Again, it's starting to show this damage trend as it's going down. Again, as you mentioned earlier, one of the things that's a mystery to us is why the measurements on the tire seem to hang in there for so long, whereas other measurements farther back in the wheel well seem to be significantly off nominal by this point in time. Again, it may have something to do with how well those measurements are protected by the tires themselves and the heat sink and the mass of the wheels themselves. Next slide, please. This is on the other tire. This is main landing gear, left-hand inboard tire pressure number one is showing some damage trend. And something else I might say at this point, too, is you watch all these temperature measurements and pressure measurements for the wheels go offline. We saw these in a staggered kind of a fashion, which indicates to us that the tires themselves did not rupture or blow up, at least not at this point of time. That may have happened after our loss of signal, but at this point in time, these measurements are going off in a staggered fashion that says that the tires were still intact at this time. Next slide, please. Back to the left outboard wire damage trend showing on one of the sensors there, the wheel temp. Next slide, please. Back to the inboard one. Damage trend there. Next slide, please. Now we finally get the landing gear left hand upward tire pressure number one to go completely offline. Next slide, please. Now the left outboard wheel temp goes offline. Next slide. Now the landing gear left hand upward tire pressure number two starts to go offline.
Doug,
yes, sir.
Once again, the people in the audience can't see the companion U graph that goes with this, which shows the actual temperature sensor.
Right.
But I'll describe, I'll hold it up. For example, which one are we on? The left-hand outboard tire pressure. The temperature is normal. I mean, there's no rise in temperature, and then the thing drops off.
The thing just goes off, right.
The temperature is constant,
and then it just drops off, right.
It just drops off.
Again,
and that's true of all of them.
Right. That indicates to us that the tire was intact, that we weren't seeing some sort of a pressure increase in the tire, that it was about to rupture, and that there was damage to the wire for that measurement that caused it to drop offline.
And whatever heat was causing all those, whatever heat it was that was causing all these temperature sensors to rise, that heat was not present up here. And
well, it was present in to some different degree. It was having different effects. And again, since it's difficult to model the propagation of how the heat was getting in there, and we're working on that. I mean, it's a difficult thing, but it was obviously having different effects there than it was farther back in the wheel well.
Let me rephrase the question. These temperature sensors here are all rising.
Yes.
These temperature sensors here, there's no temperature rise in any of those sensors. They just drop off.
They just drop off, right, which says that their wires were getting damaged.
I understand. Neither you nor I can figure out why that happened,
yes.
But these temperatures are rising, and some of them have now gone orange, indicating that the rate of the rise is now alarming, whereas these don't show any rises whatsoever.
That's correct.
Do you have a question?
Yes, Sheila.
Where is the cable located for those?
It's the blue.
Wire, the blue ones?
Yeah, the ones on the wheels themselves, the lines run on the back of the gear, back of the strut, and they run up the strut.
Well, can you sort of show it? I mean,
yeah, let's see this. Let's see, they run along the strut here. They come up to the back of the wheel well. They come to actually a kind of a junction box here, and they run across the ceiling to the front of the wheel well, and then they run out through a connector into the mid-body about there.
Okay, so they're inside the wheel well structure?
Yes, they are inside the wheel well structure.
And at least over part of their area, they're mounted on the front bulkhead of
yes.
the wheel well?
Yes, they are.
But I think that Sheila's point is very, very pertinent, because even though these sensors did not show any temperature rises, the wire that feeds these temperature goes all the way back into this region.
Yes.
And then comes back out of that region again.
Right.
Because of the way the landing gear are folded back. Folds on itself.
And if you want to surmise that maybe we're just burning through wires here, you would want to think that it was down closer to the sensors themselves on the strut, because there are other temperature measurements, again, that are coming in this bundle across the top of the wheel well and then out through that connector that are still reading and acting just fine. So if some kind of burning was going on there, it was most likely down on the strut next to the wheels themselves rather than up on the ceiling of the wheel well.
Thank you.
Let's see. Next slide. Yeah, this is the main landing gear, left-hand inboard tire pressure number one. It's gone offline. Next slide. And this is main landing gear, left-hand inboard tire pressure. Again, it's showing a very slight increase in tire pressure, a 3.5 pressure rise in 2 seconds. That didn't last very long because that sensor went offline shortly thereafter. Next slide. You can see right there in the next slide, it started to go offline, and that measurement started to trend down then. Next slide, please. Another main wheel well temperature that went offline. Next slide. And then the next to the last one went offline. Next slide. And then finally the last one. So all of our sensors, both temperature and pressure on the wheels, have gone off. But again, since it was a staggered fashion, we don't believe that one or the other of the wheels let loose, and which would have lost all of them simultaneously. Next slide, please. This particular measurement that changed here, this is called the left main gear down lock. This is a sensor which tells us that the gear would be down and locked. This particular sensor changed to a one state, which is an off nominal reading for this state. We did do some wire testing to see how this particular sensor would fail. If its wire was burned through, it would fail to a one state. So this could be either real, that said that maybe the gear did come down at this point and that we got a one because we were supposed to, or it could be just that the wire had burned through. The other sensors in the wheel well, you can see the other three red squares there, they were still all reading their nominal values, which told us that the door was up and locked. We have three other sensors. We have a door up, a gear up, and a no weight on wheels, and all of those were reading their nominal values. However, from testing that we did from wire burning to see how those would fail, those could fail in their nominal state if their wires were burned through. So it is possible that those wires were already failed, but we didn't know it. It's also possible they were reading exactly the way they should have because the door was still up and locked at this time.
Is this the same location of the previous tire pressure wire bundle and that you described before, and that is located along the center line of the gear?
Right. This particular one is along the strut. Now, the one that you see very forward there, that particular wire bundle runs all by itself or across the front of the wheel well and up to that connector. It's not in the same bundle until very late with this particular one that's failed here. So that's in a separate bundle. But the three on the gear there are all in the same bundle.
So that's the one that's located on the trunnion assembly by the dust cover where it goes through into the wing?
This particular one is on the strut itself, but the wires then run, yeah, as you described, back into the mid-body there across the top. Next slide, please. All right, this is sensor starting to go offline. One of the ones that had been reading good temperatures, system 2, left-hand aft brake switching valve return temperature, starting to go offline. Next slide, please. Now, this other wire that goes to the ASA, that was the gray wire, it actually looks kind of purplish here. This is starting to show that it was burning through somewhere and shorting. We have evidence that our air surface servo amplifier was shorting out and was not providing power the way it should have to channel number 4 for the Elevon actuators, both the inboard and the outboard. We began to see off-nominal events, and in the detailed timeline, there are quite a few off-nominal events. This is right before LOS. We're 1 second before we lost signal here. But this does indicate to us a sequence of events that I've just labeled with as one event here, that we were burning through this power wire and causing shorting to go on in that air surface servo amplifier. What we also see from the data here at this point is that the other three channels were taking over and the redundancy management that's built into the system was working the way it was supposed to be working. The other three channels took over and were in control, and this, even though this system was failing. Next slide, please. And this is just prior to loss of signal. You can see all the things are offline.
Doug, before you get to the loss of signal,
yes.
If you were to come up with some kind of a metric of event as a function of time, and you were to plot that from the beginning to this point, do you imagine that that's linear, or is there some knee in the curve? Is there some point in this 9 minutes or so here where things pick up?
Yes, I would call the knee in the curve the place where we showed the start of the sharp aileron trim increase, which is back up in one of those triangles there on the top. The vehicle was was in control and was responding to commands up to that point, and after that point, something changed, apparently, and it still continued to be in control and still continued to respond to commands, but the rates and the amount of muscle it needed to continue flying the vehicle the way it should be flown was continuing to increase. Something definitely happened at that point. Again, we don't know what, but something definitely happened at that point to cause the flight control system to need more muscle and start to have to fight harder to control the vehicle.
And that was at about...
let's go back here.
I think that's about 57.
Yeah, that would be about right.
I guess the comment I would make, because I've looked at that particular instant of time, that really coincides with a rather sharp increase in the rate of rise of dynamic pressure.
Yes, it does.
Okay, thank you. Are you...
Right, and that's as far as I'd plan to brief in these
good.
Charts.
Like Paul.
As you know, there is some data that we recovered from the satellites post-LOS. If you want to talk about that, I can answer questions about that, but I don't have any more charts.
Right. Okay, let's let Paul have the floor for a few minutes, and then we'll... And the questions, we'll see if we want to get into the 32 seconds.
You know, as I mentioned before, what my team has been doing is evaluating various public imagery, various external sensors, and trying to make some sense out of the data to see if we can get smarter about what's coming off the vehicle early on as far west as we can, as well as get some kind of engineering data to tell us specifically what those objects are, where they're going. I don't really have prepared presentation charts. I'm going to wander through some discussion on this map. I have a few other pictures I'm going to show you. And I did bring a composite video that shows examples of continuous video from the California coast through about mid-New Mexico. Since this video was put together, we have added one that takes us about 50 miles offshore of California. And we have some video from Kirtland Air Force Base that takes us through just about the New Mexico-Texas border. Those aren't going to be in this tape that we're going to see here in a few minutes. Let me start with the process, then we'll play the tape. To give you an idea, when we first started getting these videos, our first job really was to put them in chronological order. That's still photographs, video, et cetera. We very quickly focused on just the video and saved a lot of the still photography analysis for later. Our first goal was to establish some absolute reference for time in each one of the videos. Once we have that, we could put them in chronological order. And as we were going through that process, probably 3 or 4 days after the accident, we first saw in these videos individual debris shedding events, and that was our first indication that something, in fact, was coming off the vehicle early on, that we didn't just start having structural damage, say, over west or east Texas. And you'll see as we play the tape some of the things that we use for cues in establishing time or establishing relative geometry. There are a couple of celestial references in a couple of the tapes. We see a star. You'll see a Venus crossing, which will be very clear. At least half the photographers snapped their GPS location, so we know exactly where they were standing. In the case of the Venus crossing, because we know where that photographer was standing and we see the orbiter actually fly in front of Venus, we can calculate when in time that had to have happened, so now we can put that tape exactly where it was in time. We know exactly where the orbiter was in space, and then we could sync the videos that preceded that one and the ones that followed to that tape. And we had a few other cues like that in other tapes, and I'll try to describe those as we go when we play the tape. As we started seeing these debris shedding events, and you'll see these in the tape, although some of them you do have to look closely because they only last for on the order of a second, second and a half in most cases. We then set about calculating the exact times that the debris was coming off the vehicle. And as we established those exact times, we went to work trying to do relative motion and ballistic analysis. And I'll come back and talk about that here in a few minutes. Interestingly, not only was NASA not aware that debris was coming off that early, before we looked at this video, but most of these photographers did not see any debris shedding in their own photography until they heard about the accident on the radio or on TV and went back and played back their videos, then they could see them. Like I said, in most cases, the debris flash or the speck that you'll see in the video lasts for a second and a half or so, in most cases, less than a second. The types of things to look for in the video, in some cases there's flashes like Doug talked about. In other cases you see a bright dot, which is just the orbiter and the plasma wake behind the orbiter, and then you'll see another dot come from that dot. And you'll see when we play the video, we are not seeing images of an orbiter against a dark sky where we can clearly make out the plan form or the shape of the spacecraft, or we can clearly resolve down and see where some object is coming off the vehicle. You see a dot, you see another dot appear from that dot, one of the dots goes away. And we'll talk about that some more as the video plays. The other thing to think about as we watch the video is we are making some speculations about what we're seeing. We think that the brighter objects are more massive, are more significant, potentially higher ballistic numbers. Certainly the things that the individual light for the individual pieces of debris persists longer, we expect that those objects are more massive, higher ballistic number, because we think that the reason they persist longer is they are moving faster, so they stay lit. They have their own plasma wake longer than, say, some lighter thing, say if an individual tile comes off versus maybe some other heavier object. But I'll also say we cannot just look at these videos and determine what is it that's coming off the vehicle. Are we losing a tile here? Are we losing some section of frizzy or the thermal blanket that's on part of the external surface of the vehicle? We can't tell that. And to this day, with the good data that we have on the ballistic motion, I mean the ballistic analysis and the footprints, we still cannot say exactly what it is we see coming off. We are making some judgments on which of them are more significant or more massive than the others. And we talked about debris 6 and debris 14. And when we play the video, you'll see why we're focusing on those. So why don't we go ahead and play the video, and then we'll come back and I'll talk some more about what we've done on trajectory analysis.
You can feel free to stand up and narrate or point or whatever it is, however you feel most comfortable showing us what's happening.
Where are we playing the video at?
I don't know.
Oh, there
it goes. There you go. Turn down the lights.
All right. Okay, now this is just over the just after the California coast. Now, as I mentioned, you see a dot. That's the orbiter. And the view looks more or less like this. As we change the vantage point, you'll start picking up the contrail. Now, if you blinked, you missed that. That was debris 1, and that was debris 2. Those little dots that came off, that was debris. As I mentioned, you can't make out the plan form. You really can't see the orbiter, and you have no idea what's coming off. Also, as I mentioned, on some of these, well, most of these, the debris itself doesn't last very long at all.
Now, this is a significant event coming up soon.
Mm-hmm. Now, this bright dot you see here, this is Venus. And when our flight dynamics folks saw this, they were very excited because this allowed us to put this video within plus or minus a second when it actually happened.
Flash.
Now, you can see the flash persist in the wake, and then you see debris 6 come off. And even though they're separated by a few seconds there, our speculation is the flash was some burning event associated with debris 6, and then that object coming off the orbiter.
And if I understand it, debris number 6 is the one you tracked to the vicinity of Caliente, Nevada, and we are valiantly trying to find.
We do think that is debris 6, and I'm going to show the footprints for that and explain that a little bit more. And there you saw debris 7 come off. Now again, also just for a reference, all of these are taken with camcorders. These are commercial camcorders. This is somebody in the public standing outside with a camcorder, generally zoomed way in, trying to track the orbiter flying overhead 12,000 miles an hour by hand.
Debris 9 and 10. I recommend people pay attention to debris number 14. That's the other one that's significant.
Now, as we come up on debris 14, to think about is how bright that flash was before debris 6, and compare that to what debris 14 looks like. Also, for comparison, debris 6 was lit from between 6 and 12 seconds. Now, there you saw how bright that was, and you also saw that you have this cloud where around the orbiter, the video itself or the pixels became saturated. That is the most bright, the brightest object that we saw in any of the video. And I'm going to come back and talk about its relative motion and debris 6's relative motion here in a few minutes. Now, you can see here we're getting further east. We're getting out over New Mexico. The sky's lightening up, which makes it more and more difficult in the videos that we have out there to track the orbiter and specifically to pick out individual debris shedding events.
But in your experience and the experience of your experts, that hot gas envelope right there looks just like any other hot, just like any other entry that you know about.
That's right, except for any of the flaring or flashes or anything else.
Except for that.
The bright spot you see there looks just like all the other videos that we have. As a matter of fact, one of the photographers that sent us this video sent us 6 previous entry videos that he took, most of which with the same camera. And they look just like this, except absolutely no flares, no dots coming off the dot, as it were.
The number down the right-hand corner is what's on the camcorder, but that's not calibrated time. Your times are in the bottom left-hand corner.
That's right. Now, we have done a fair amount of work. Either, again, about half these photographers were amateur astronomers, and they had synced their clocks themselves to atomic clocks. Some of them went back and taped the atomic clock so that we could do our own calibration, and some of them did some of that afterwards. Now the things you're seeing here are just prior to or including the main breakup.
But this is post loss of signal.
Correct.
Right. This is.
We left this in here for completeness. We're going to talk a little bit about post breakup and pre breakup trajectory analysis. So I thought we would go ahead and run the tape through this, just give us a place to start from. These videos were all taken from Texas, of course.
That might be the left hand.
This was taken from an Apache helicopter looking through its forward-looking IR targeting sensor. The thing to think about here, and we'll come back and talk about this in a while, is the significant number of secondary, tertiary breakups that you see in these videos.
That'll be important when we talk trajectory analysis.
Okay.
Can I ask a question?
Yes, ma'am.
Are there any gaps in time missing where you don't have video? Say, is there a continuous timeline between the first sighting and these later pictures? Are you missing anything?
There is a small gap in the East Texas or the East New Mexico, West Texas area. It is not as big as represented on this tape.
Okay, how long is it? 2 minutes?
I want to say it's on the order of a minute or 2 minutes. Everything else west of Albuquerque, we have near continuous video for. Now it shifts around from vantage point to vantage point, and there are dropouts in individual video. As a matter of fact, we segue into the map here for a few minutes. The blue dots that you can see on the map, those represent where the individual photographers were standing. And take this one for example here. This is in Flagstaff. This blue line extending out this way, and there's another extends out this way on the map. That wedge represents the full part of the trajectory that photographer filmed in his camcorder. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that photographer has continuous coverage of the orbiter for that full swath, because many of them dropped track, or they lost the orbiter. They looked away from the viewfinder. Camera came down. They had to go find it again. But
for the most part, with all of the overlapping video we have from California all the way through New Mexico, we've been able to piece together essentially continuous views of the orbiter. Now, the other important thing is, on some of these objects, where we see them coming off the orbiter from in one view, we may not see that same object coming off maybe for another second or so in another view. And in some cases, we don't see it from a different vantage point of the same incident. Some of that is because one observer, say, may be looking from the north side of the trajectory, like you see these folks up here, and there's folks down here videoing from the south. And one of them may have, the orbiter itself may be obscuring the view of, say, the flash or the individual debris coming off. And since that debris only persisted for maybe a second in most videos, then it wouldn't take much obscuration at all for one video not to see it. But the short answer is we have near continuous video until right about here, and that's east of Albuquerque, New Mexico. Then there's this gap, and we pick up again with that Texas video of the main breakup south of Dallas.
Do you have a gap between Albuquerque and...
Albuquerque and about the Dallas area, which I guess you would expect because of the relative population. Most of the video we have, even out here in Arizona and New Mexico, which is relatively thinly populated, most of that we have from Albuquerque, from Flagstaff, and from Las Vegas. And the one from Flagstaff in particular, they track for a significant period of time, from horizon to horizon. So that's our explanation for the gap there. Now, going back to the video a little bit, you see the type of relative motion or the type of relative distances you see in the objects that come off the orbiter. We're able to zoom in on those objects. We're able to zoom in on the orbiter. The imagery folks here at JSC are able to take all that jitter out so that there's no motion except for the relative motion between the object and the orbiter. We can then measure how that object moves away from the orbiter, and since we know exactly where the orbiter is in space relative to the photographer, we know exactly what the timing is, we can then calculate the ballistic number of that object based on how it moves relative to the orbiter, because we know the orbiter's ballistic number, of course. We then take that ballistic number for the object, and we propagate that down and build a vector so that we can propagate the object forward all the way down to the ground. Then we generated a series of footprints at 80,000, 35,000 feet, and ground impact. And if we can put up page 2 of my charts. We've done a couple of things. What you see here is a very generic footprint. We started with this before we could calculate relative motion and ballistics off the video. We made some simple assumptions, like we were shedding a tile every 2 seconds from California all the way to Texas. Based on the known ballistic properties of a tile, that gives us a debris swath that looks like this, which is still enormous. And it's about 30 miles above, 30 miles below the ground track for that full distance. That's what we knew very quickly, like within a day or so of the accident. If we move on to the next page, similar footprint based on the main body breakup, also based on various simplified assumptions on ballistic numbers, both for light and heavy objects. This footprint is for the debris field in East Texas, and it in fact is centered right over the debris in East Texas. And on the far right side, down in the lower corner, that's near Fort Polk, Louisiana, which in fact is where main engine components have been found. Now again, these are both very generic, and they're based on relatively wide, simplified assumptions. If we go to the next page, this is based on debris 6. This is that object that we see coming off somewhere near the Nevada-California border. And in fact, this footprint lies over in this blue line here. That's the New Mexico, Utah, not New Mexico. That would be the Nevada-Utah state line. The small box you see here, if we exactly nailed the debris shedding time, if we exactly nailed our ballistic analysis, that's where you would expect that object to be laying, if it also didn't generate any lift. We've done a bunch of other detailed analysis. If we go to the next page, just for comparison's sake, depending on the errors that we have, it is just as likely that the object, instead of landing in that no lifting box here in the middle, could have drifted off track to the north, off track to the south, just by generating lift. If we had some error in the time that we calculate in that object coming off or in our ballistic analysis, then it could also fall short up here in this part of the footprint, or long down here. Can we back up a page, please? Now, again, this is debris 6. This is the first one we had analysis on. We were able to get analysis completed on this one earlier because we had that Venus crossing, and we really knew the relative motion of this one much better than we knew everything else. After we built the footprint, then the process would be go through the FAA radar data, which we have saved off and recorded, and we're working with the NTSB then to search that radar data to find patterns that would not normally be noticed by air traffic controllers. And in that process, we have found a thread up here near this area, which is just inside Nevada before crossing into Utah, and another one down here just south, and then another one over here in Utah near Mount Zion National Park. These are the first three radar threads we found, and in fact, these are the three areas that we have been trying to search here for about a month now. The one in Utah is very mountainous terrain and is most likely only going to be searched by air. It has been searched already by air. We're talking about doing some more air search. This one up here in Nevada, which is near a place called Caliente, Nevada, we have had folks on the ground there searching. It's also snowed out there about 5 times to the tune of 4 to 5 inches of snow each since February 1st, which certainly complicates our problem, both searching and finding things. Let me also say again, we don't know what this object was. We know that based on its relative motion, it has a ballistic number on the order of 3.75 to 4.75, which compared to an orbiter ballistic number, which is on the order of 100 to 110, makes it something that's relatively small and light. Like you said, Admiral, we expect this object to be debris 6. I mean, the objects that we're finding the radar threads for, we expect to be debris 6 because it lies right in this debris 6 footprint and so close to the no-lifting box. We don't know for a fact that it is because, as Dr. Eiler said, as these things come off the vehicle, they could continue to fail, break into smaller pieces, which then completely changes their ballistic properties. Our general process is the same, though. We calculate relative motion, calculate ballistics, propagate out this footprint, and then we search the footprint for radar threads. If we go to the next page again, this is debris 14. This is that second object that was so bright compared to debris 6. Let me correct something that I told you on Thursday. Debris 6, you can see persist, depending on the video you look at, for between 6 and 12 seconds. Debris 14, we see persist for 4.5 to 7.5 seconds, depending on the video you look at. But debris 14 also is much, much brighter than any other object, including debris 6. How do you interpret that? Well, we're not sure. We do think that relative brightness is an indicator of something that's larger and more massive. We think that the amount of time that individual flares or the light around the debris persist is also indicative of the larger ballistic numbers, which tells you you're dealing with something probably that's larger and heavier. But that's as much as we know. We know how these things behave ballistically way up high when there's not a lot of air. In addition to just searching these footprints for FAA radar, we've also moved all the way out west to the west coast of California, and we are searching all air traffic control radar anywhere that intersects our ground track or that wide generic swath around the ground track to again see if we see any patterns of Columbia debris falling through that radar that would have been ignored by air traffic control. And to date, we still have not found any threads out there. And as you know, we have not found any of the Columbia debris laying on the ground out west based on these threads. Now, searching the radar databases is relatively labor-intensive. Clearly, putting people on the ground out there to search even 5 square miles is labor-intensive. We have since started testing various shuttle components up at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base at the Air Force Research Lab. Our initial focus was on that Flight Day 2 object and to try to determine what we could do to identify what may have fallen off the orbiter or fallen out of the orbiter, if in fact that's what that object is attributable to. So for those radars, we specified a list of thermal protection system, predominantly a couple of different types of tiles, a couple of different types of blanket-type insulation that's on the outside of the orbiter. We're also going to send up an RCC panel, a carrier plate, and the horse collar, or that thermal seal that goes around the carrier plate. Those are all in work right now. And we sent up some different types of thermal insulation to go in the payload bay.
Once we had that in work, it occurred to us we could do similar type radar testing also at Wright Pad that is tuned towards the radars, these air traffic control radars that we are looking for our debris falling down through. And that also is in work. And for many of those materials, that testing too has already been completed. And we are expecting the detailed results sometime this week. And by the same token, we are looking to identify a set of SRB components and ET components, and we'll have the full set tested for the C-band radars we track during ascent, UHF radars we track while we're in orbit, and then the L-band air traffic control radars that we're dropping debris down through here. All of that is supposed to tell us, is it reasonable to expect that we could track the materials that are most likely to have come off the orbiter? Or, to look at it another way, how big would those materials have to be? So would we have to have a tile the size of a car to be able to track out here? Or is it reasonable to think we could track a single tile or a piece of tile? And I expect that we'll have information on that here within the week. Now, that gives you an idea of how we think we're going to find any of this debris. And as Dr. Ehler said, the key to finding or looking for this debris is we know what happened more or less in East Texas, at least at the gross level. It'll be difficult for us to do trajectory work with the debris we find in East Texas and back it up to the vehicle to try to determine what was happening over Texas. This debris could tell us where the breach started, and if we can locate some of this and use it to isolate where the breach on the outside of the vehicle started, that's going to make us immensely smarter on exactly how the failure started in the first place. Now, at the same time, there are some folks out at the Ames Research Center in California that are capable of analyzing the spectral data, the luminosity in the video and the still photography, and it's possible they'll be able to give us some engineering data on exactly what's burning, exactly what they see coming off in the plasma wave. Probably the easier of the two analyses will be looking at the relative luminosity, and it is possible that by looking at and measuring the luminosity of the debris in video, comparing that to the orbiter's luminosity, where the orbiter is not saturated in video, we know what the orbiter's instantaneous drag is. We can use the ratio of that drag and the luminosity, compare that to the debris, and it's possible we'll be able to estimate the actual drag on the debris, which then makes us smarter about what's coming off. Our initial hope was to also get good enough spectral data to resolve down the actual material. Unfortunately, we expect that the three colors we get in commercial camcorders will not be good enough. In combination with the distances they were shot through, the fact that a lot of this light was having to go through both the orbiter plasma wake as well as some plasma wake around the debris, our hopes are much, much lower that we'll get good spectral data. But we're setting up feasibility tests for both of those out at Ames Research Center using ArcJet testing. And we expect to have those tests set up and in works sometime here in the very near future. The last thing I'll tell you about is the miscellaneous sensor analysis we have in work. Again, the first one is something that we were originally very hopeful in. We are much less hopeful now, and that would be in the world of infrasonic analysis or infrasonic data. There are various types of microphones that are set up across the continental United States and out in Hawaii. They did measure sound data on the orbiter during this entry. They have similar data on previous entries. We thought that it would be possible potentially to bring some of that sensor data back to the orbit ground track and essentially give us a calibration or a signature of these debris shedding events as they occur across the ground track. And we have since found that the various variables associated with bringing that data back to our ground track and back to our place and time in the sky are probably going to be large enough that we're not going to be able to do that. So we expect that not to pan out. We had various other DOD sensor data, like radar, and then there are other types of data like that that we also have evaluated and we have put on the timeline, and you've seen some of those. Most of that data also, regardless of the type of sensor, is not good enough to specify, say, engineering properties or specify any kind of properties on any individual tracked object, unfortunately. We had originally hoped that we would be able to track individual pieces of debris coming off the orbiter, specify vectors on those things, and use those to be smarter to get them all the way to the ground. And across the board, the types of sensor data, the external sensor data that we have is not going to be good enough to do that. And interestingly, the public video we have is probably the best data we have to try to find some of this debris out west. Let's see, the last thing I guess I could tell you on the ground track here without going into a lot of detail, I mentioned these blue dots are the photographers. The white dots you see are on the ground track, each one of those is the individual debris shedding event. And if you stand back and just kind of look at the view from 10,000 feet, you can see that from California pretty much all the way to Texas, you see a relatively steady stream of objects coming off the orbiter. Now, there's a few places where you don't see as much. That doesn't really necessarily mean that we don't have small pieces of debris continuing to come off the vehicle. It could just be the perspective or the point of view during that phase of flight, and the photographers just couldn't see it. Likewise, you don't see any of these white dots out here where we don't have video because we don't have any way of seeing it. But I think it would be a valid assumption that we were continuing to drop debris all the way through there. And it is likely that if we had video during this time frame, because we had a lit sky, we wouldn't have seen individual objects coming off unless they were relatively large and you saw some bright flare.
Paul, why don't you show with your pointer there the furthest west piece of debris that's been found? Just to...
Well, let's see. Westernmost piece of debris was found just south of Lubbock, which, let me look on here. I want to say is right around in here.
Okay.
I think that's right. Let me also say for that westernmost piece of debris, that little field tile, which is generally how we refer to it, we have done some top-level trajectory analysis on that. We expect that piece of tile came off somewhere in this time frame here, potentially while we had video from Kirtland Air Force Base. But that also is based on the mass properties and the size of that tile in its state on the ground. And, of course, if it was part of a larger piece higher up in the air, then it probably also came off much earlier than that.
But that trajectory analysis you just spoke of, that does include true winds of the day, though, does it?
Yes, sir, it does. Now, what doesn't include true winds of the day is that generic swath you saw from California all the way to Texas, although we are in the process of putting real winds of the day in that. And let me also say, can we go back a page on my slides, please? Now, I don't show the radar threads here, but again, I mentioned here around this word BAM, there's a radar thread, probably the radar thread we were most interested in that we followed, where the radar thread is just the long string of radar hits that we followed in this pattern on a Cedar City air traffic control radar that we think is attributable to debris 6 or some piece of debris 6. Now that radar thread started right about here, again right on the ground track, right where you would expect a non-lifting object to be, and then it tracked to the north and east, which also was with the prevailing winds of the day. So, you know, our interpretation of that is, as that object dropped down into the heavier air, where you would acquire it on air traffic control radar, which is about 80,000 feet, then it fell ballistically above that, got down into the heavier air, started becoming more lifty, started lofting with the winds, and then again it started tracking here to the north and the east as it came down lower. If you look at the topographical map of that radar site and where that object lost track, our speculation there is that we tracked that object to within about 1,000 feet of the ground, which is why we think we have about a 5 square mile search area for that object out west. Let's see. That was everything I was going to tell you kind of in the big picture in how we're doing what we're doing. In general, we're continuing with the relative motion analysis on all these objects. I expect here in the next couple of weeks we'll have ballistic footprints rolling in at a relatively regular rate, starting with debris 1 and 2 out west and then working its way east. We also expect that we're going to see those footprints start to stack up and overlap significantly with debris 6 and debris 14, and then we're working on figuring out from those overlaps how to come up with concentrated search areas based on where we think it is most likely we'll find any and all of this debris out west.
So this piece that you've tracked to 1,000 feet above the ground, there's no question that that arrived at the ground, but is there a question about a lot of this other debris as to whether it would have likely just been burned up?
Let's see, the debris that we have radar threads for, any of the ones we have radar threads for, if you assume that those are our debris, which is still somewhat of an assumption, then we are relatively confident that those are on the ground somewhere near where we lose track with those objects. Now, the other things that we see in video very likely could have either burned or completely disintegrated from G-loads or aerodynamic forces before they got to the ground. We don't know.
But if you say 14, say 1 through 14, can you say off the top of your head how many of those came up on radar?
Well, I can answer a different way. We have about 4 key radar threads that we are searching
out west. There's these three here that are in the debris 6 footprint, and there's another one in Albuquerque that did not come from this analysis. It was started based on some folks in Albuquerque that thought they heard something fall through the sky and impact the ground. And the NTSB found those radar threads. Now, if you assume those are ours, we think we are reasonably confident that those things are on the ground somewhere. All the rest of these that we don't have any radar threads for yet may or may not have made it to the ground. We have just now started searching the debris 14 footprint for radar threads. So we could go another 1 to 2 weeks before we have finished searching all of that radar to determine whether or not we see these patterns.
And around how much of the areas where you're searching are you dealing with snow-covered ground?
All of these areas out west, certainly in the Nevada-Utah area, have been snow-covered off and on at least 4 or 5 times since February 1st. Matter of fact, the primary search box out there near Caliente, Nevada, was on hold. We had about 15% of that area to finish searching, and it's been like that for 2 weeks, maybe going on 3 weeks now, all because it was snow-covered. If we're looking for something small like a piece of a tile, it's reasonable to assume you're not going to find that on snow-covered ground.
What can you say about still photography? Has that been of any value?
We are doing some work with still photography. There's some photography that was taken from California in particular that was time-lapse photography that may yield us the best spectral data. It did give us a few more cues when we were trying to narrow down maybe 1 or 2 seconds on debris shedding timing. I don't expect we're going to get a whole lot smarter from the still photography than that, however. But we are buying still cameras from many of the photographers, just like we are the camcorders, so that we can try to calibrate what we're seeing in film and get a better idea of what kind of spectral data we can pull out of it. In the ideal case, we'll be able to take some of that still photography and clearly show that we have aluminum burning in the plasma or maybe silica or maybe RCC. But we'll see.
Did you want to talk about the Kirtland photograph?
Well, yes, I can talk about that a little bit. I've been working on a Tiger team to try to understand the images there. There were a number of images acquired at Kirtland by the folks there who were doing that on their own time, not using the Starfire optical range equipment. They did have some pretty sophisticated home-built stuff, but it wasn't the Kirtland Starfire equipment. They did manage to get 4 videos and 3 stills. I think some of those have been in the media already. We are trying a number of ways to deconvolute those photos to try to make them as precise as possible to see what sort of images we can get off of them at that time. There do appear to be some irregularities in the shape that we see from the still. We have to still run that down and find out, you know, what exactly the shockwave field should have looked like from that point of view around the orbiter at that time, whether or not we would have expected to see it look like that, whether we would have expected to see it be different. As you know, we've already shed quite a few pieces of debris by the time we got there. We were also able to pull one more piece of debris out of the Kirtland video and the 2 flares that I talked about.
Let me put that out of the way, Admiral. We are capable, using the same techniques we've used for measuring relative motion from the video, we are capable of drawing pictures of exactly what the orbiter should have looked like to those Kirtland photographers, whether it's for their still photo or for their video. We're then capable of using computational fluid dynamics, of projecting what the flow field should look like around those pictures. And then we're also capable of taking that and handing it off to plasma physicists like at the Ames Research Center and generating what the plasma wake should have looked like around those still images. And then we can compare those against what's in video and what's in that still photo. I would caution anybody in reading anything into either the video or the still photograph until we've gone through that process. The vast majority of people that have studied those images are imagery experts. They're not experts at what the orbiter looks like during entry, the flow field around the orbiter, plasma dynamics, or anything like that. And we're definitely premature trying to read engineering conclusions into any of those images before we've gone through that process.
Thank you very much. Members of the board here, any more questions?
I have a question. I want to make sure I understood something that you said. I asked you about whether there was a time gap in coverage, and you said there was, basically you don't have any video pretty much between Kirtland and the more spectacular big events.
That's correct.
And you said that you thought there was a that you expected that during this time gap that there probably was continual debris shedding, but that you didn't have pictures of it.
I think it's reasonable to assume that.
But it also might be possible that there was, in fact, a catastrophic event, such as losing a wing or something like that.
Well, I can't say that
You can't say it.
I can't say that technically didn't happen.
But it can't be ruled out on the basis of the data that you have.
It would definitely surprise me personally to think that we had something significant like loss of a wing that is not covered in the later video that we have of the main body breakup. Based on what we have in telemetry, and we know how the vehicle was flying, we know what other sensor data that we have. I mean, my personal full expectation is we capture that in the video just based on what we see in the timeline.
So where is loss of signal relative to the gap that you have in video?
Loss of signal is over Texas, so we have data from the vehicle.
So you're saying you have data from the vehicle,
yes.
That covers this region in time,
yes,
where you don't have video.
That's right. These red dots, these red dots you see here, all of these represent actual GPS vector measurements.
Okay, so you do have data during that period.
Right,
we have data
through that video gap period, so yeah, it's highly unlikely that any very large piece of the orbiter, like a wing, would have come off because we still have data from all of our systems then.
Okay, that makes sense.
Even though they were failing, they were still there.
Now, another way of saying that, if you look at the map then, is these blue lines show you everywhere we had video. Everywhere where the line is red on the ground track, we had data coming down from the orbiter. And then where it's yellow is the LOS time frame.
Okay, fine. Then the second question really concerns this debris 6 and the flash. As I understand the observations that were made in California of the flash was unusually persistent, and it also was stationary in the atmosphere. So the question is, what is it? What do you think it is? Do you think it is aluminum burning in the atmosphere?
It is possible it is something that burned and came off the vehicle. It is what you would expect to see if we were to, say, vent a fluid, or if we were to burn something, and as we gave off combustion products, significant combustion products, not something on the order of, say, one of our reaction control system jets, but if we were burning something substantial, and as we put that out in the plasma wake, you would expect, because that would have relatively no mass, certainly would compare to an object, that those combustion products would immediately go essentially static compared to the orbiter or compared to what we consider normal ballistic behavior for an object that has significant mass. So it is reasonable to assume that something came off that was very light, or that was some kind of combustion product, like potentially aluminum slag that also was burning as it came off the orbiter and then went stationary there in the wake and looked more persistent.
Are you ruling out the possibility that there could be a chemical reaction that was stationary? In other words, are you assuming that as soon as it was all by itself in the atmosphere, it was not reacting?
Well, I'm not assuming that at all.
Because that's what your words seem to indicate.
All I'm trying to say is it is difficult, if not impossible, for us to get much more specific about what we're seeing technically, other than we see this bright thing come off the orbiter, and there are a handful of things that could lead you to believe as to what those objects are or what the phenomena are, like a flash or the persistence of that flash. I agree with you that the persistence of that flash certainly indicates that you either have continued plasma wake around something or some continued reaction.
Okay.
The fact that it becomes more or less stationary would also suggest that it is something that is extremely light, probably more like a cloud or a combustion product.
Okay, I just want to make sure that we're talking the same language.
But you're the best that you've been able to analyze so far, that flash that precedes debris shedding number 6 is not merely a disturbance in the hot air. It's not just a wave or of the hot air or the hot gases around the orbiter.
Probably not. Just due to its persistence,
right.
It is telling you that it is more than just something crossing through the wake.
That's right.
Something else is happening there.
A question on the far end of the timeline. The SSMEs, I've heard some opinions that those three bright objects you see in the last daylight video might be the SSMEs. I would like your opinion on that. And then I haven't heard that we've recovered much of the SSMEs. Do you expect to? What are your thoughts on that?
Let's see. First of all, we do expect that those three bright dots in that Apache FLIR video are main engines or large components of the main engine. If you look at how they're behaving ballistically, they are certainly objects that are very heavy, relatively high ballistic numbers, and because they're so bright, they're continuing to move really fast. We also know from radar data and, for in fact, the SSME components we have found in Fort Polk, Louisiana, that, in fact, the engines or large components thereof did stay intact for a long period of time and did go further east than any of the rest of the vehicle. And I don't know personally, maybe Doug does, how much of each of the main engines we have found. I know that we do have main engine components that have been found and shipped to KSC.
Yeah, that's true. I don't have a reading on how much of each engine we have found. We could get you that number.
But, you know, that does beg the question on what we can learn from post-breakup trajectory analysis. Everything that I have talked about is pre-breakup. My entire team's focus has been pre-breakup. Everything that we have been trying to do is figure out what's coming off as early as possible and where is it. So that we have some idea of where did the breach start, what caused the waterfall of events. It is certainly the opinion of the trajectory experts here at JSC that taking the debris field as we find it in East Texas and trying to reverse propagate it back up to the vehicle is not something we are capable of doing. Again, going back to the FLIR video from the Apache helicopter, you saw all those secondary, tertiary breakups. As soon as you have additional breakups and those objects then become free flyers, they each have their own individual ballistic behavior. They're all now going somewhere else in the sky. We take a GPC we find laying on the ground in East Texas. We can back it up into the sky to some altitude, but at some point we lose all truth, we lose all accuracy, because that GPC at some point was in an avionics bay, which at some point was surrounded by the crew compartment, and at some point was
the GPC surrounded
by
general purpose
computer. One of the shuttle main computers.
Yes.
The fact that we know how it behaves ballistically doesn't mean we can take it all the way back up to the orbiter, because at some point it was surrounded by other structure. If we could take the initial main breakup and assume that all the components we found in East Texas became free flyers at that point, we could do a pretty darn good job backward propagating those things all the way up to the orbiter. But we know, in fact, that it didn't happen that way. And then, as Dr. Ehler said, even the individual components, say the individual pieces of tile that we find on the ground, whether we find them out west or, say, this little field tile, we don't know that tile or that object came off the vehicle looking like that. And your full expectation for something fragile like a tile is that, in fact, it did come apart. Using some of the video, we know in several cases that the object, when you go frame by frame in the video anyway, as you're looking at the object, you see a white dot come off the orbiter, and then you see that white dot shower into a lot more dots, and then you see all the light go away. Probably indicative of something breaking. Now, is that several tiles coming off together and then flying apart, or is it a tile coming off and then shattering into a lot of pieces? We have no idea.
Thank you.
Mr. Tetrol.
As you're probably aware, we have found both of the forward corners of the left wheel well structure. And that's where the wheel well door interfaces with the structure itself. So you have the inboard and you have the outboard corners, each of which demonstrates some venting coming out from the wheel well itself. Now my question is, if that's in fact going on, wouldn't you have an interruption to the plasma? And wouldn't that show itself to some degree perhaps as a flare?
Maybe. And I hate to not be more specific, but again, it depends. How did that hot gas get into the wheel well? Was it flowing in or was it flowing out?
No, we're talking here about an outflow from the wheel well at the corners.
Probably.
Forward in.
Again, it depends
and
on...
And it has an effect on the tiles at least, it's a guesstimate, 12 inches to 18 inches outboard from that venting. So it's quite a vent, if you will.
Possibly. I mean, if you assume that occurred pre-breakup and while the orbiter was intact and still flying through the sky, it's possible that a jet like that coming out of the wheel well might change the plasma wake, might change what the orbiter looks like to video taken from the ground. But we don't know that.
It depends on what direction was the shock, what direction was the plasma wake flowing in that is normally around the orbiter, and did that jet actually make it all the way to the normal plasma wake and cause a disturbance? Or was it hidden or shielded behind the plasma wake that already existed around the orbiter? We don't know the answer to that. Mm-hmm.
Mr. Hubbard?
Yes, two kinds of questions. First type is has to do with where all the material, raw material, came from. Obviously, we owe the public a great debt of gratitude for such cooperation. Can you tell us how many different submissions or contributions there have been, and then how many you sorted it into, and a little bit about how you determined what was useful and what wasn't?
Sure. Within 3 days of the accident, we had almost 1,000 reports. Actually, probably within a day or so of the accident, we were approaching 1,000 different reports that varied from people calling in or sending emails to say, hey, I looked up in the sky and saw this bright dot go overhead, to I saw something happen and I want to talk to somebody about it, or videos where somebody called and said, hey, I have a video and I think I see something coming off the orbiter, or I have still photography and I think I see something coming off the orbiter. Do you want it? For the first day, we spent most of our effort sorting through a stack of close to 1,000 reports, and then within about 2 weeks, 3,000 reports that were all across the map, just like that. We very quickly figured out if we were going to learn anything technically or anything of engineering value, it probably was not going to be in the reports where people say, hey, I looked up and saw something in the sky. Unless they said, I looked up and I clearly saw something fall through the sky and smoke was coming off and that thing hit the ground close to my house. And there aren't very many of those. So we very quickly narrowed down to, let's look for videos as far west as we can. Let's look for still photography of the orbiter in the sky as far west as we can, particularly time-lapse photography, and let's look for people that are amateur astronomers, because those people are going to have a lot better secondary data, like GPS coordinates and exactly where they were standing, exact zoom settings on their cameras, things like that, or exact time references, say, in the case of the video. Within a week, we had it narrowed down to about 15 videos that form the core of what we now have on this map of the videos that actually show debris shedding that we were able to time correlate to within plus or minus a second. And then we spent some time after that first week or so prioritizing which of those did we have the best celestial cues in, which of those did we think we were most likely to be able to calculate relative motion. And then, which of those, like debris 6 and 14, did we think would be so substantial that we might have a chance of getting them all the way to the ground, finding them in radar, maybe putting boots on the ground and going collecting hardware. So I would say it took us about a week to sort out the initial round, maybe a week after that before we knew very well which of the videos, which of the stills were going to give us any meaningful data. And from there on, it was a continuous process of analyzing the video, measuring the relative motion, generating these footprints, and then searching through radar. And without the public having taken these pictures on their own, because to our great surprise, people are still very interested, apparently, in the space program. And these folks got up before sunrise and went out on their own and stuck their cameras up in the sky. Most of them also knew exactly where to look in the sky because, again, they were amateur astronomers. Without those folks, we wouldn't know any of this. I mean, these people are definitely our heroes. And there are about 15 to 20 of these people or these videos that are probably the most key to us having been able to do any of this analysis.
We join you in being thankful for that. It's also thankful that it was a crystal clear morning across the entire southwest part of the United States, too.
Mm-hmm. Oh, you bet.
Did you have any other questions?
Yeah, just a follow-up. One is, there was a lot of debate early on about whether or not we were seeing some type of just bright gas or whatever. How confident are you when you've labeled an event in the timeline as debris that it actually is debris?
I'm not sure how to answer that. We are reasonably confident. I would say I am confident, if not sure, that many, if not all, of the things that we label as debris shedding events are, in fact, some object coming off the orbiter. Can I tell you, is it golf ball size or is it the size of this sheet of paper? I can't. It could very well could be something as small as a marble in most of those videos, and the ones that we think are so significant and that have gotten us so excited, those things could be golf ball size. We really don't know.
We know relative sizes, we know relative motion, but we don't know specifically what they are. But we are very confident, based on the way they behave after they separate from the orbiter, that they are in fact separate ballistic objects or objects that have mass in almost all cases. In the cases of some of these flares, they could be something different, like combustion products.
Right. And just the final follow-up to this line of thinking here, when somebody sends something in, how do you determine that it's the real deal and not been cooked up by Photoshop somewhere?
Well, you know, for one thing, for most of these videos, we have had them for we got them probably within a week. First week to 10 days.
Month and a half or so.
Well, we got them within a week, week to 10 days of the accident. In some cases, we had them before that. It is possible, I guess, that some people could go and doctor them up. My expectation is we got most of these so quickly, they didn't have the time to go do that. The other thing is we have, in most cases, we have overlapping videos, so we have redundant cues. And, in fact, we are taking advantage of that. We measure relative motion from one. We go back and we measure relative motion of the other, and we can compare them. I would say they'd have to be really darn smart to have doctored two opposite videos and give us the same relative motion answer.
Our image analysts have also discovered some hoaxes that have been out there in the public and know they're hoaxes and have identified that. They've also identified some things that have been anomalies or quirks of the way the photograph was taken. A jiggle of the camera, for example, that produced an effect in the photo that looked real but was not real. It was an artifact of the way the photo was taken. They've also dispelled some things. Some of you may have seen what looked like a triangular shape when we were zoomed in close on the orbiter that appeared to actually be showing the orbiter in some detail. That wasn't it at all. So they have been able to sort out the hoaxes and the false images and the artifacts from the things that are real. So
well, and actually most of our early hoaxes, and we did get some early on, were cars driving down the road with their headlights on. I mean, it was relatively clear to us that it wasn't something in space.
Admiral Turcotte, you have the floor.
One last question for me, anyway. With your analysis of the radar and your being able to integrate the timeline and the photographs together, what are you surprised at the amount of wreckage that we have? I.e., do we have more than you expected from that analysis, or do you think that you're surprised at that the amount that we do have?
I give you two answers. Pre-breakup, I would say we continue to be shocked that we had debris coming off the orbiter as we crossed the California coast, and we're dropping debris. Clearly had an external breach in the vehicle and had hot gas somewhere in the left wing for that significant period of time. And the vehicle flew perfectly, no indication of what was going on in flight control, and virtually no indication of what was going on in telemetry on the ground, other than we saw a few temperature pressure indications that didn't make sense to us, and we had a few sensors that dropped offline. But aside from that, the vehicle flew like a champ until right up until the breakup. So that did surprise us. Now, for the things that we're finding in East Texas, are we surprised that we only have 15 to 20% by weight of the orbiter? I don't think so. I would think when you first see the debris count and you see how many individual pieces of debris, our first reaction was one of surprise. How could we have gotten that much of the orbiter down from 200,000 feet intact? Of course, I think you've all seen at KSC, what they have is a whole lot of little tiny pieces of what used to be an orbiter. And if you go look at it laying on the ground there in the high bay at KSC, you don't have a spacecraft laying there. You got a whole lot of nothing. And I think that does fit in what our conventional wisdom was prior to this happening.
General Deal, we'll get the last question.
Oh, good, because I've got three of them.
No, you don't.
Paul, real quick, a follow-up to Scott Hubbard's question. Are you still expecting any more imagery, or do you think the well has run dry? Anybody indicated there's any more exist out there?
No, sir. I think for the most part, the well has run dry. Again, most people contacted us right away. We had most of the video in hand within a week. Overall, the support from the public has just flat been overwhelming, so I would expect not to get any more in. Now, there have been two isolated cases out west of two individuals that strung us along for several weeks before it finally became apparent to us that they must have been under the impression they were going to collect on the Columbia gravy train. And it did take us a while to figure out why they trickled an individual image to us or an individual video to us that that is, in fact, what was going on, that they must have discovered this is their 15 minutes.
Go ahead,
but they are the huge exceptions to the rule.
Go ahead,
the
go
overwhelming
ahead.
Support has just been fantastic, and I think we have it all.
In the early days when the Admiral took us to Nacogdoches, there was talk about it everywhere from offering a bounty, money incentive mm-hmm. for people turning in parts, you know, going out in the fields and looking for it, to certificates from NASA to thank them. Are any of those still under consideration, or are we just in a debris collection mode?
To my knowledge, we are not planning on offering any rewards to people to incentivize them to come forward if they haven't already. I can tell you the folks here that are doing the work have every intention of, when the dust settles, to come up with some formal recognition. We have various folks we want to recognize. In my team's case, we definitely would want to recognize the people that took these images for us and made all of this possible. And there are various things that, at the working level, we are kicking around that we would like to do. And I am sure the program will do something before this is all over.
Great. Thank you. One more for Doug. You gave us an excellent tracing of all the sensors and how they failed. You've had plenty of time now to do some reflections and some lessons learned. Anything that you've already considered that we ought to be thinking about as far as sensor wiring, sensor location, or junction boxes and how they're constructed?
I'd have to say no. We it's probably too soon to speculate on any type of redesign that we might want to do with our instrumentation. As you know, the instrumentation wasn't designed to have flow inside of the wing, and so it probably failed in the way we would have expected it to. So as of yet, we have not considered any sort of internal redesign to better protect that instrumentation or even make more instrumentation available.
Gentlemen, on behalf of the board, we want to thank you for appearing today, but I hope you will also take back to your working groups, which I know you are the tip of an iceberg of literally hundreds of people that are working with extreme zeal and professionalism to try and solve this riddle, and because many of us have visited your working groups and we know how many people are working on this. And please pass on to all of them our deepest gratitude and our deepest respect for the work that you all have done and will continue to do. We appreciate it very much. We haven't solved this thing yet, but someplace in your work, we'll find the answer, and we appreciate it very much. Thank you for appearing here today. Appreciate it.
This was provided by the minister. They want them back.
Sure.
Okay.
Are you collecting these?